TV series Succession. Admittedly, he's talking about his own children when he just says, I won't do the accent. You are not serious people. How often do you think that when you encounter what passes for political commentary or political coverage in the UK media at the moment? Brexit? Obviously. COVID? Obviously. Liz Truss, 14 years of Tory rule, obviously, have done more than anything else to create the economic situation that the current government is charged with navigating. Why is it so hard for some people to admit that?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the Chancellor has refused to rule out tax rises in her upcoming budget, saying she'll make the necessary choices. In a speech from Downing Street this morning, Rachel Rees warned everybody must do their bit for the security of the country. She pointed to a series of global challenges to the UK economy and also blamed the Conservatives for years of economic mismanagement.
We finished the pandemic with higher death rates and higher debt than our peers. This isn't about relitigating old choices. It's about being honest with the people about the consequences that those choices have had. It is my job to deal with the world as we find it, not the world that I might wish it to be.
The Tories say Miss Reeves' speech shows that she's panicking about the speculation that she's fuelled about potential tax rises, while the Lib Dems say it demonstrates that the budget will be a bitter pill to swallow. LBC's political editor Natasha Clark was at number 10 and listening to Rachel Reeves' speech.
Taxes are going up, but it's not my fault. That felt like, to me, the message that the Chancellor was trying to make, setting out why she thinks that Brexit, COVID and the Tories are all to blame for this. And she repeatedly refused to rule out breaking her promises to the people last year in the manifesto, which vowed not to increase VAT, national insurance or income tax.
And the Chancellor, Rachel Rees, will be speaking exclusively to Tonight with Andrew Marr here on LBC from 6 o'clock this evening. In other news, investigations are continuing into whether a man accused of a stabbing attack in Cambridgeshire is linked to other knife offences. 32-year-old Anthony Williams has appeared in court charged with the attempted murder of 10 people on a train on Saturday. Police are now also looking into separate reports of a man with a knife in Peterborough on Friday evening. Train passengers have been told not to travel north of Preston until tomorrow after yesterday's derailment in Cumbria. The Avanti West Coast train struck a landslide near Shap. 4 people suffered minor injuries. And the owner of Primark says it's considering splitting the retailer from its food business. AB Foods is reviewing its structure after annual profits fell 13% to £1.7 billion. It also owns brands including Kingsmill, Ryvita and Twinings. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 101 points at 95.99. The pound buys $1.30 and €1.13. LBC weather, wet and windy for much of England and Wales today. Drier for northern Scotland and southern England, feeling very mild though, with a high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Good morning. It's 3 minutes after ten. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Taxes are going up in the budget. That much is clear. The point of the speech today, because apparently some people haven't worked this out, is essentially to... prepare the markets for that imminent shock, or even to render it not as shocking as it would otherwise be. One word I've seen used by people who know what they're talking about is pitch rolling. She is breaking a manifesto pledge, but she's not going to actually shatter the glass in the course of a speech 3 weeks before D-Day. And what I found most extraordinary was two things. I don't know on a scale of 1 to 10. This might be a question that I ask you. How stupid not to have done this a year ago. How spectacularly stupid to have waited a year. In fact, more. Would that be an interesting finding? Why didn't they do this in opposition? To which I suppose the most obvious response is, excuse me, they won a massive majority. How can you possibly be picking holes in what they did in opposition? To which I suppose I'd respond by saying, well, opposition should be preparation for government. But why didn't you do this in opposition? Why have you allowed this nonsense to get halfway around the world before the truth has got its trousers on? Do you know, I heard people today, this morning, who told you to vote for Brexit, who explained to you that it would be a brilliant idea, that Boris Johnson would be a brilliant Prime Minister, that austerity was a necessary corrective because the banking crisis caused by bankers had nothing to do with bankers, and the prices must therefore be paid by, you know, teaching assistants in your child's school, the closure of libraries and youth clubs, and a massive reduction in the provision of things like leaf sweepers for your local council. Like the people who told you Brexit would be brilliant, Boris Johnson would be brilliant, Liz Truss would be brilliant, austerity was brilliant, are now saying, how dare she mention Brexit? Actually, let's pause for a moment just to reflect on the incredible combination of ignorance and dishonesty that you would need to deploy to shift effortlessly from championing Brexit while not understanding anything to, as the reality of it begins to settle on a population, claiming that we shouldn't talk about it anymore. We should move on. If you were an arsonist, how keen would you be for everybody to move on from the fact that you've just burnt down their house? Answer, very keen. So let's call an arsonist an arsonist. That's what they're doing now. It's frankly extraordinary, and you only need a tiny reminder of how bent the British media is when it comes to chiefly those three or four issues, Brexit, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, austerity, to remember that it doesn't end. You kind of naively think that a morning will come. I get exactly the same thing on January the 6th with Donald Trump. I just thought, okay, that's nice. We can all go back to normal now. We can all admit that this is a terrible aberration in our democratic development. We can go back to being on different sides of political arguments while agreeing on what the rules are, what the pitch looks like, and what constitutes a foul. We'll go back to having a referee who can blow the whistle. You've seen January the 6th. You've seen an attempt to both deny and overthrow a democratic election result in the United States of America, orchestrated and presided over by a man who is lying to everybody. And for about an hour, it looked like that had happened. It looked like everybody was saying, well, you know, I quite liked him in the past, but this is obviously too far. You can't be going around lying about election results and approving of violent mobs descending upon the Capitol. And then what? Fast forward a month, a year, 2 years? It's as if that never happened. It's quite extraordinary. I thought, naively, that something similar would happen with Brexit. I really did. I thought, naively, that the reality would become consensus. I thought we would all be able to agree. Oh, what a fool I was. I mean, imagine Farage, for example, ever admitting that it was a disaster. It's probably easier to imagine that in some ways. If there was a few quid in it, he'd probably admit it was a disaster tomorrow. But the idea that they would say, oh, I'm terribly sorry, we made a mistake. The people in my profession, the idea that any of them would ever say, I'm terribly sorry, I should never have told you that Boris Johnson was going to be a brilliant Prime Minister, that Brexit was going to be good for this country, or that Liz Truss was an economic genius. But you'd think, I don't know. So I should be unsurprised by that extraordinary combination of ignorance and dishonesty, because we've seen it pretty much everywhere for the last 10 years. But I think I am surprised, and I shouldn't be. This is where the naivety kicks in. I shouldn't be surprised that they now are saying that you've got to stop talking about it. They don't think that the Chancellor of the Exchequer, when explaining the fiscal environment in which she has to make her next budget 3 short weeks from now, these people don't believe that Rachel Reeves should talk about the single biggest contributors to the state of the economy.
The decision to pursue a policy of austerity after the financial crisis dealt a hammer blow to our economy, gutting our public services and severing the flows of investment that would have put our country on a path to recovery. The years that followed were characterised by instability and indecision, with crucial capital investment continually sacrificed and hard decisions put off again and again. And then a rushed and ill-conceived Brexit that brought further disruption, as businesses trying to trade were faced with extra costs and extra paperwork. All this meant that when the pandemic arrived, our country was underprepared, our public services weakened, and our economy fragile. And we finished the pandemic with higher death rates and higher debt than our peers. This isn't about relitigating old choices. It's about being honest with the people about the consequences that those choices have had. It is my job to deal with the world as we find it, not the world that I might wish it to be.
Why now and not last year or 2 years ago? None of those things are new. Okay, there's a vague argument about how not fully appreciating the full extent of the disasters inflicted upon us by that sort of triumvirate of terribleness, Brexit, COVID, austerity, all of which are, in a way, political choices. COVID, obviously not a political choice, but how you handled COVID was a political choice. The notion that we've ended up with higher death rates and higher costs than comparable economies is a direct consequence of the decisions taken by the people who were in charge. Have you got a favourite? I probably prioritising cronies and party donors for juicy PPE contracts over people and companies who had long histories of working in precisely that sector. That might be a contributory factor. Hey, at least one of our peers got a new yacht out of it, presumably, they say, as the champagne corks pop in the background. Austerity, again, making everybody's life worse. David Cameron's epic miscalculation, and in many ways the reason why Brexit got over the line was because he introduced policies that made people think that the country was sort of fraying at the edges. Very deliberate attempts to essentially charge you for the sins of the banking industry. That's a little bit simplistic, but austerity was a choice. It was not a necessary response to the fiscal situation. And then Brexit. This extraordinary, a choir of voices this morning claiming that she shouldn't talk about the things she has to fix. I mentioned it already, but that line from Succession, where you are not serious people, it's never been truer, has it? You are not serious. Oh, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll call her Rachel from Accounts, because then we don't actually have to admit that we don't understand anything. We'll call her Rachel from Accounts, or we'll talk about the national insurance rise, which was possibly ill-advised. But in the great scheme of things, you want to set that against Brexit, COVID and austerity inflicted on this country. COVID management, Brexit and austerity inflicted on this country by the Tories. And you think that the national insurance rise is a significant contributor to the mess that we're in. Jeez, man, have I got a bridge to sell you. And yet you open up your newspapers, you turn on your radios and your televisions, and it is as if 80-90% of the people paid to offer up their opinions are still shilling for Brexit, still shilling for austerity, still shilling for Boris Johnson, the Boris Johnson legacy. Doesn't get worse than being shunted out of power by your own party, but hey-ho, up he pops again like an unflushable item, and throwing shade at everybody. It just baffles me that as a country we are still in thrall to the lies and the nonsense of the last decade. So you're going to have to pay more income tax. And the reason why you're going to have to pay more income tax is the same reason why all the reform councils have just revealed that they're not actually going to be able to make any savings at all. They're going to have to put council tax up by 5%, despite all being elected on a promise to cut costs or to save money and to reduce council tax. Because that is what happens when you get bitten on the backside by reality. And what the champions and the cheerleaders of Brexit, COVID management, Boris Johnson and austerity are doing at the moment, again, is telling you to ignore austerity, to ignore reality, to ignore the consequences of the thing they told you to vote for. I mean, it's so dry tax territory normally that I'm surprised that I'm quite emotional about it, because I'll tell you what patriotism is. Patriotism is feeling your blood boil when you see your fellow countrymen and women being lied to by people in positions of power. And I'm thinking more about the media than politicians now. When you see people who are decent and doing their best being lied to about the reasons why the country is not performing on anything like the level that it could and should be, and the reasons for that failure, the reasons for that fragility, are political decisions and political choices championed by precisely the people who this morning are telling you to ignore Brexit or to move on from austerity. Or why aren't we I tell you what, why don't we blame it all on William the Conqueror or Guy Fawkes? It is a combination of such extraordinary carelessness. You can only hold these opinions if you care about nothing. If you care about nothing except getting to the finish line, professionally speaking, filing your column, finishing your contribution. It's absolutely insane that in 2025 we're still counting the cost of things that the people responsible for want us to stop talking about. So what on earth is the phone in? What on earth is the phone in this morning? 0345 6060 973. What is the phone in? I don't think I'll get away with that. Why is she doing it now? That's the question. It's not the sexiest question of the morning, but it is, for people who actually follow politics and understand things, it is by far the hardest question to answer. Why is she doing it now? This should have been said at best in opposition and at worst a year ago. Saying it now is just strange. That triple punch, that triple whammy, austerity, Brexit, COVID, cost us an absolute fortune. COVID was going to cost us a packet, however it was handled, but it cost us more than it needed to because you put Boris Johnson in charge of the country. I'll say that again. You put Boris Johnson in charge of our country. The Labour Party turned it into a choice between a rock and a hard place, of course, by having Jeremy Corbyn in post as leader of the party. So nobody's off the hook on this. We're all responsible for the fact that we approached COVID with Boris Johnson in charge. Austerity. How many times have I sat here and reminded you that the very definition of right-wing politics for the last 150 years is protecting wealth? Wealth boiled us all during the international banking crisis, the international financial crisis. David Cameron came off the back of it, essentially saying to your nan that she had to pick up the bill. Absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? That they are now telling you that they want you to move on, want you to stop talking about. So why is she now asking the question and making the point about that triple whammy, that hat trick of horrors, that blindingly obvious combination of catastrophes, Brexit, austerity, COVID? Why is she doing it now? That actually, let's do that first. If you don't ring me, I'll come up with another question. But why now? Why not in opposition? Would it have been that awful? Would it have involved drop-kicking the Ming vase into the dress circle? Would it, if she'd said that? That promise not to raise taxes has become such a sort of beast on her back, hasn't it? Today's speech was about preparing the ground for shrugging it off, letting the markets know what was around the corner, and letting you and I know that we're going to have to put our hands in our pockets to help make up some of the shortfalls caused by, wait for it, Brexit, COVID and austerity. In fact, don't worry, Keith, I promise I'm not going to go all the way through to 11 o'clock, but this is one of those mornings where once I start actually thinking about stuff, I marvel at what they have done to our country. The combination of conservative politicians and conservative media have created a country in which we are telling the Chancellor of the Exchequer not to talk about the three biggest contributors to our economic situation as she prepares to announce a budget designed to address our economic situation. It's a bit like telling a football manager not to talk about the football, or the goals, or the offside rule, or tackling. Oh, just move on, will you, from the goals? Move on from the offside rule. Why are you still going on about that now? The offside rule was invented 125 years ago. Why are you still talking about it now in your team talk? Stop going on about tactics. Stop talking about... It's insane. And yet that is where we are, all these years later. That is where we are, sitting here, watching a media politician combination create a context in which the Chancellor of the Exchequer can be told not to talk about the things that are most relevant, most pertinent to precisely the situation she's going to seek to address in 3 weeks' time. And I'll tell you now, if you're using the phrase Rachel from accounts, you are absolute proof of what I'm talking about. Don't actually engage with reality. Don't engage with responsibility for the things you were encouraged to vote for last time. Just engage in a little bit of misogynistic bullying. That's all. That's the answer to your problems. You blame everything on foreigners except when you're blaming it on women. It's man alive. So, oddly, given the fact that I am rather cross with the context in which Rachel Reeves' speech has been greeted, I'm also rather cross with her. And the question I've got for you first is not about all the idiots that told you Brexit was going to be brilliant and are still pretending that it could have been, or indeed even worse, even more dishonest, even more deranged, claiming that we should somehow stop talking about it. I'm not talking about the people who inflicted austerity upon you and on me, or indeed the people who mishandled and mismanaged COVID so hideously that we lost more people and more money than we needed to. I want to know why you think she's only doing this now. Why has she waited until 18 months, give or take, into the first Labour administration in a decade and a half to actually lay out the reasons why the country is creaking? Why? Why has she waited until now? And I want you to explain it to me in a way that ideally makes me a little bit more sympathetic to the situation rather than this extraordinary combination of befuddlement and anger. 03-45-6060-973. It is blindingly obvious that Brexit, COVID and austerity have created the fiscal mess we find ourselves in. Why has the Chancellor of the Exchequer waited 18 months to say so? 03-45-6060-973.
LBC.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
At Harwoods, we know your car says a lot about you. Maybe that you like to make an entrance, or you'd rather make your escape. That you want to cut a dash, or just cut your emissions. That you like to take the bends, or bring your four-legged friends. Whatever, we speak your language. Come and have a chat at Harwoods Audi Crawley and Five Oaks and Harwoods Volvo Crawley. Details at harwoods.co.uk. Harwoods, family owned since 1931.
Hi babe, yeah, mad day, so do you fancy staying in tonight instead? Delivery fee is now from 99p on the Mackey's app, and we can get a free chicken Big Mac if we spend £15, so you in? Of course you are.
Exclusively on the McDonald's app, £15 spend only on main day food and drink via delivery until the 19th of October. 18 plus, service fee and small order fee may apply. Participating restaurants, serving times and T's and C's apply.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to just say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
If only there was a way that could work with your advertising campaign. Well, there is. And you're listening to it. Because when you amplify your advertising with radio, 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
23 minutes after 10 is the time. Do you know what I'd also like to do, but I don't know that it would work as a phone-in? Have we always been this detached from reality? Is it a consequence of this extraordinary coalition of corruption between right-wing politicians and right-wing media? But the idea now that half the country thinks that we shouldn't be talking about the reasons why we're in such an economic mess. Did it used to be like, I honestly can't remember, did we used to be this absurdly detached from reality? The misinformation, is it an online thing? I don't know, but I do know this. She should almost certainly have talked about this sooner, and I want to understand why she didn't. Patrick's in St. Austell. Patrick, what have you got?
Hi. Listen, I think, really, you've got to kind of scroll back a bit. Everything you've said is absolutely true, of course.
Of course.
But I'd take you back to 1992.
Go on.
Okay, and the Labour Party had lost 3 general elections to the Conservative Party. And everybody was thinking, right, yeah, they're so fed up with the Conservatives now. Yeah, this is it, right? And the Conservatives, right, mounted a very successful election campaign based on the fact of terrifying people that if Labour get in, oh, you know, the economy, look at it, it's a bit dodgy, they're going to raise taxes, they're going to do that. The double whammy.
Yeah, do you remember the double whammy?
And then you've got to scroll forward now to the election last year. How many general elections had the Labour Party lost to the Tories? I think it was 5, wasn't it? And you've got to put yourself in the mind of people. Well,
two Camerons and a Johnson, 3.
Wasn't there another?
5 prime ministers, 3 elections.
Okay, so what happens is, it kind of, how can I put it? It takes a bit of your boldness away. When you've lost that many elections, by the way, always telling the public that public services are being run down, the Labour Party went on all the way through the early, telling everybody, look what's happening to the health service. Nobody listened. The Tories kept on getting in.
This is pot kettle a bit, so forgive me, but slow down a bit.
Yeah, sorry.
That's all right. You're in good company. if they'd said, maybe not, I mean, there's 3 lines here, isn't there? Why now, why not then, and why not then? With the two thens being opposition and early days of government. So your analysis works on opposition. Why not do it in opposition? Because you'd have the posters with the red eyes on it and all of that stuff. And that is where, in a way, I'm being a bit foolish, because I'm describing the environment, this corrupt coalition of conservative politicians and conservative media. And that's part of the reason why you couldn't do this in opposition. But why couldn't they get this out of the way? Why didn't they rip the plaster off in year one?
Because I think the clue for me is how long it took for the first budget to come out. And I think what happened was they opened the books and found
4 elections. Theresa May in 2017. There you go. We'll split the difference. You said 5, I said 3. The answer's 4.
Okay, the point is, it just takes the sting out of your boldness when that happens to a party, any political party. And then when they got in, she opened the books, and that, I think, is why the first budget took a long time to come. Because they found, in black and white, in numbers on the page, a 15-year economic nightmare that frankly, most governments try and keep from the public. But the point I'm really trying to get at is, when you lose that many general elections, it just does something to the spirit of, we're going to grab this thing.
Excess caution. No, I like it. I like your analysis. And it does actually make me a little bit more sympathetic to the situation that they find themselves in. But it's emotional, what you're describing, isn't it? It's a state of mind, right? It's not substantive, and I think you're probably onto something, but that is what a political machine should be countering. They should be saying, look, I know it feels as if we've got to tiptoe everywhere, but we're in power now, and the sooner we tell the people the truth, which most of them know anyway, I don't think I'm going to put Russ in idiot's corner, because Russ is just speaking for precisely the people that the corrupt coalition of conservative politicians and conservative media exist to brainwash. I mean, this is exactly why it happens. It's how it happens, and Russ is who it happens to do. It's nothing to do with Brexit. It is a product of this crap government. Ooh, what's this? A black hole I almost fell in. Sure, it wasn't here when we did our manifesto promises. Oops. So, I not just ignorant of the most simple to understand facts and observable evidence, but also reveling, performatively dismissive of reality. Brexit, COVID, austerity. Oh, it's nothing to do with that. It's all because, Rachel from Accounts, National Insurance, something, 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 house rental, something. It works so completely that someone like Russ genuinely thinks he's got a better handle on the facts than everybody from the governor of the Bank of England to the wisest fiscal heads in the land. Brexit, COVID, austerity. Done to you by the Tories. Mismanaged by the Tories. Inflicted on you by the Tories. Rachel Reeves, fix this mess. Tory press, don't mention Brexit, COVID or austerity. Like John Cleese in Fawlty Towers, trying not to mention the war. Except they haven't got away. Well, they probably have got away with it. Chris is in Bedford. Chris, what would you like to say?
Yeah, good morning, James.
Hello,
first
Chris.
Time caller.
Welcome.
Not for want of trying.
Well, there you go. Try again, Chris. There you go.
How to get a word in edgeways. Your previous caller summed it up quite neatly. I mean, the why not in opposition? Clearly, if you're in opposition, you raise the red flags the press get it up against you, and you're not going to get into power. Why now, once they're in power? Well, you know, you do your best within what you thought you could do, the promise. It's not a promise in a manifesto. It's an undertaking, and undertakings change as circumstances change. I mean, the politicians who are unwilling to change, given a set of circumstances, are idiots. So anyway, so why now? Because they've tried very hard, they can't do it, and it's like, right, okay, time to bite the bullet. This, getting us out of the mess of the last 15-plus years, is all about shared endeavour. That's everybody. That's me, that's you. Mm. According to your means, pay more tax, because the only thing that can fix this is more tax. I run a business. I employ people. I pay them as much as I can afford. I pay corporation tax. I'm delighted to pay corporation tax because it shows we're making money. And this is what grieves me about the people who say, oh, no. Try and make it everybody else's problem. It's not everybody else's problem. It's our problem. Collective,
it's our problem. You're a kinder man than me, or a more sensible man than me. Well, because
I don't think so.
Well, no, because you've cut to the heart of the issue, which is the necessity of all of our shoulders going to the wheel, whereas I'm still slightly handicapped by what I feel towards the people who built the wheel. Do you see what I mean? I mean, suggesting that she shouldn't talk about Brexit, COVID or austerity when describing a budget designed to undo some of the damage inflicted on us by Brexit, COVID and austerity is palpably stupid. But I want something from, it's probably the Catholic in me. I want some atonement. I want some self-flagellation from the people who did this to us. And instead I'm getting them saying, oh, you've got to move on, or Brexit derangement syndrome, or just a simple requirement for acknowledgement of responsibility for disasters. And instead what we're getting is, oh, Rachel from accounts, and don't mention the bloody war.
Don't believe for a moment that they're ever going to work.
No.
They're not, because Brexit is a hideous. I mean,
Losing the phone line now, but you've made your point. You're brilliant, actually. Chris, I'm glad. Excuse me, I'm just going to have a quick word with the producers. Chris, wait there. Why did this man not get on before? He's a genius. Why did we not? He's a beautiful combination of compassion and insight. What on earth are we doing not taking his calls more often? Chris, I look forward to your next contribution to the programme. 10:31 is the time. Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
The Chancellor has given her clearest indication yet that taxes will rise in the budget later this month. In a speech from Downing Street this morning, Rachel Rees warned that each of us must do our bit for the security of the country. Sir Alan Bates has reportedly reached a seven-figure deal to settle his claim over the Post Office Horizon scandal. The former sub-postmaster has been leading the fight for justice for victims for more than 20 years. And online pornography, which shows women being choked, will be banned under planned legislation as part of government efforts to tackle violence against women and girls. LBC weather, wet and windy for much of England and Wales today. Drier for northern Scotland and the south of England. Feeling very mild, a high of 17. Degrees.
This is LBC.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Trains are three bridges for two adults, one skeleton and one fairy werewolf, as you do.
Just one pumpkin each, kids! Charlie, not that one, mate. It's nearly as big as you.
Back on the train with two little monsters and a couple of pumpkins. Now off home to spend a good 3 hours carving. Download the Thameslink Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story.
We had our smart meter installed a year ago, and it's made things so much easier. Not having to submit meter readings or having to deal with estimated bills is great.
A smart meter sends meter readings direct to your energy supplier. It means you get accurate bills, not estimated bills, and you don't even need an internet connection. Call your energy supplier to request a smart meter today.
Real testimonials voiced by actors. Eligibility may vary.
Private healthcare sounds pricey.
At Benenden Health, it's less than £16 per person per month.
Just for GP calls.
For a 24/7 GP helpline, physio, diagnostics and more. Now, tell me.
All about my medical history.
No, no medical questionnaires or hidden charges. We like to call it
healthcare done different.
Spot on. Benenden Health. Healthcare done different. Fee review periodically. 6-month wait for some services. T&Cs apply. Selected surgical procedures after 6 months. 24 in Northern Ireland. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60
973. ABC, isn't it? It's as easy as ABC. Austerity, Brexit, COVID. You don't want to talk about the easy stuff. You don't want to talk about the reasons why the country is in comparative turmoil, economically speaking. Then what do you want? So the state of the nation is less important to you than avoiding responsibility or admitting your mistake when you encourage the population to support austerity, Brexit and Boris Johnson. It's incredible, that. How big does your ego need to be? You just wave the flag and go, no, I'm sorry, look, I got this wrong. I shouldn't really have offered up any opinions at all on Brexit. I didn't understand any of it. I realised immediately after the vote that I didn't understand trade. My name's Dominic Raab and I didn't know that there was a lot of trade between Dover and Calais. Literally made him Brexit minister. And he comes out and says, well, I was very surprised to discover there's a lot of trade between Dover and Calais. Hello? 10 years later, and the same people are now saying, don't talk about it. Shut up about it. And when Rachel Reeves explains, it's as easy as ABC. Thank you to Andrea for pointing out that rather pleasant alphabetical phenomenon. Then they tell her to shut up. And you can hear her on with Andrew Marr tonight from 6. I think her first broadcast interview, a brilliant interviewer, Andrew Marr. So he will be cutting to some of the chases that we've set in motion today. Chiefly, for me, in terms of what we've set in motion, why now? Okay, I think we're clear on why not in opposition. The notion that it would have scared the horses, even if it was true. But why not now? And it's a double header, actually. Marr and Marks. Simon Marks joining me at 11:45 to have a little look at the election, the mayoral election in New York today, which is a particularly interesting one. But it is to British politics that we dedicate our attention now. Simple question. Why now? Why has Rachel Reeves waited until now to state the bleeding obvious? And it's not just, of course, on the points of ABC. It's also the stuff about tariffs. It's also the stuff about Trump, you know? Why didn't she do it when Trump introduced them? Was it because they didn't want to upset him? It's the point now of citing tariffs and increased defence spending as reasons for the almost certainly imminent tax rises, broad-based tax rises. Why? Because we need to spend more money on defence. Because trade has got more expensive as a consequence of tariffs. Those are like your side orders. That's your garlic bread and your tomato and mozzarella salad. Your main course, your lasagna, your pizza, your Alfredo is austerity, Brexit, COVID. Why now? David's in Manchester. David, what do you think?
Hi, James. First time caller, but a long time listener, so keep it easy with me.
Of course.
I agree with everything you say. I'm a Labour voter.
Right.
I campaigned for Labour. I door knocked. I went round, door knocked for Labour, went out of my own constituency. I can't tell as a Labour voter how upset I am with Labour at the moment.
Sure.
And the reason I think now that Rachel Reeves is coming out now, and albeit I agree with everything that she says.
Yes. Because it's true. It's a bit like agreeing with the observation that the Pope is Catholic or that rain is wet.
But James, the truth is, and this is why it's upsetting me, is that what's the messaging? The whole campaign was about how people felt and how people experienced and what the conditions were, how poor people were. But the trouble is now, I hear a Labour government, I hear Labour politicians who I know care, they generally do care. But their messaging is so void of care. When Rachel Reeves says this morning, and this is why it upsets me as a Labour voter, when she says she's doing what's right, she's basically saying, well, do you know what? You've just got to put up with it. You've just got to suffer. I find now as a Labour voter, the empathy coming out of the Labour Party is so little. But I know there's lots of MPs who are empathetic to people's experience. The whole thing with Brexit is blatantly obvious. You've said it for years. But Labour have never mentioned it. It was the elephant in the room they were scared to mention. And I think she's mentioning it now because she knows how important it is. But I also generally think it's the only punch she's got left. The messaging is void. If I'm a leader,
what would you have done instead? Because I mean, I've puzzled over why this didn't happen sooner, because I couldn't genuinely see any alternative unless they won the lottery. In economic terms, we found gold under Shropshire.
Door knocking in Labour's campaign, the messaging was not very clear. It was a great campaign. It was door knocking. It was going on. But it was not about what Labour could and should do factually. They knew the mess what the country was in. But when he takes steps to punish the pensioners, when he takes steps to punish the poorest people and national insurance. I've got a small business, incredibly difficult. National insurance, got all these aspects. And it's things which could have been taken later. They could have been, we could have increased. But
well, hang on, do you know?
But people are, I think what people are tired of at the moment is being hit in every direction.
Well, no, but the message now is that we're going to have to hit you again, but that was always going to be true. Do you know, you've made me think of things differently, but not necessarily in the way that you intended. So maybe an extraordinarily stupid, tone-deaf, whatever adjective you prefer, the winter fuel stuff, from every imaginable angle, even if you want to mount a defence of elements of the original policy decision, the way it was sold to the people was, I mean, just breathtakingly bad. But that and the national insurance stuff, maybe they thought that they could. Why they would want to, I still don't know. But maybe they I mean, this is a stretch, David, don't get me wrong, but maybe they genuinely thought they could just reset the course. They could just nudge the oil tanker in the direction of turning around by doing those sort of things, and they'd be able to keep their manifesto pledge not to raise taxes. And they made an absolute pig's ear of doing the smaller things they thought they could do to fix some of the mess. And for reasons I don't understand, they didn't want to talk about Brexit, austerity and COVID. Less so, but still on the same list of things, you know, in case of emergency, break glass. And it's because that they failed in the first instance with the two things you've cited, that now they have to do this. Yes, of course you can. Well, I don't know. Well, you can ask it, but I'm not promising to answer it.
No, it's a question I've asked a number of people. It's a question I ask myself now. If the Labour Party came out tomorrow with the greatest policy which could be ever be done for the country, who would be the person from the Labour Party you would think would have the credence, the ability to come and speak to the nation, where the people would go, oh yeah, I get that, I understand what you're trying to do. It might take a bit of pain, but I am struggling within the Labour Party at the moment to think of somebody who could stand in front of the country
and tear the plaster off.
And yeah. And not just that, be the doctor tearing the plaster off, but as the patient understand, this is why we've got to do it. Because the communication, whoever, I know they've changed the communications and the network of people behind them, but their ability to communicate messages is probably the worst. And I am Labour through
to the
core.
I know you are.
And I cannot think of any other government which has been so poor at getting any messaging. There's been such good things done, and it hasn't got across to people.
There's a bit of chicken and egg. I mean, it is the state of the billionaire-owned media that partly explains why it is almost impossible for them to get a break even when they get something right. But that is only part of the answer, and not even necessarily the big part of the answer. What name pops up most often when you ask people that question, before I answer?
Do you know what? This is the problem. There isn't. Honestly, because when you talk about the positive, like Healy's a good one. He comes out and speaks. But it's that it's the real, and I do feel quite upset about the Labour Party at this point. I don't find there's somebody who has that emotional attachment to people in the country who can say, I understand your experience, I share your experience, this is what we're going to do. Rachel Reeves talking this morning, she's such a poor speaker. It doesn't come across well. Her messaging is good and it's correct.
I don't care that she's, because if we had someone who fits the bill that you describe, it wouldn't matter that we have a Chancellor who's not a natural orator.
We're in that mess at the moment as a country. you always talk about the US. The US is in the same thing. They are struggling to find that democratic voice who will speak to people, who will communicate it. And I generally think Labour is in the same boat now. Even though they're in government, they're desperately trying to find communication methods. And I think that's why we've gone out with the Brexit this morning. I think it's a clear message. It's something people can rally behind. It's people understand it. It's binary. It's either worked well for you or it hasn't. And I think that's why we've done it. But now they've got to follow it up. They've got to do something with it. They've kicked the ball. Now they've actually got to follow and actually do something with it. And that's what worries me, because I just think they aren't going to do it.
Well, they are. They're going to put your taxes up.
Well, but that's what I mean. And
they have to. But people, unless people understand that they have to and why they have to, then it will become an even bigger millstone, an even bigger disaster.
That worries me. They won't get that message across. And it will cause...
I mean, this is chicken and egg, because if they don't get the message across, it will be, at least in part, because of all the idiots shouting, austerity, Brexit, COVID, everybody move on, why are you still talking about these things? Brackets that we inflicted on the nation, but please never mention them again, close brackets.
And I was listening to the beginning, Kemi Badenoch, who's just come on.
Oh, Lord, really?
And I just think to myself, that's the problem. If people like that, and Farage and stuff like that, If they have the ability to get their message across and hit, and it's not always the right-wing media, I think the communication ability of the Labour Party is so poor. If they get that right, people will go with it, but they don't, and they just hit... Sorry.
That's all right.
I just find, as a Labour voter, I get so upset about it, because I never thought I'd find a Labour government who is so lacking in empathy and understanding of what people are going through. I just can't believe it.
And they may not be. They may not be lacking in empathy, but they're not providing any evidence that they have.
Yes.
I think that's at the heart of your point, is that you still believe in your heart of hearts that this is a government that does care. They're just not showing it enough. Do you think, because we're going to run out of time, and I can't believe this is your first contribution to the programme, you're a natural. Is Starmer toast, do you think?
I listened yesterday in Parliament when he was talking about... Hillsborough and talking about it. And he's what I don't understand, he's a man who's got obvious emotional understanding
literacy
of what people feel and whatever. Yeah, and he has that ability.
I agree with you.
I don't understand why, though, they can't allow him to go out and be that person as the Prime Minister. It's like a cardboard cutout of him. But when you hear him speaking yesterday and you can see the emotion in him,
on Hillsborough, but when he talks about violence against women and some of the things he did as DPP, there's the emotion is raw, it's real. But you're right, the average voter probably never sees it. I don't know. Did you answer my question about what name gets mentioned most often when you
did? And I'll be honest with you, when you talk about it, people don't mention it because when I ask them, I think they're void of ideas and people. It sounds really silly, and I think this is a problem. Like the issues around Jess Phillips and the work what she's doing with women, which is significant, it's huge, it's a huge amount. But the coverage she gets is also negative, it's so poor, and it's as though every time somebody brings their head up, they don't have the ability, or Jess Phillips before would have come out and just gone on the attack. She was going, you know, you talk. But
yeah,
it's like
it takes a toll, doesn't it? It's almost as if they've created precisely the sort of world in which people who are not part of that corrupt coalition between conservative media and conservative politicians either can't get heard or are frightened of speaking out. I think probably social media has contributed to that as well, that notion of... Are you looking at the polls and the support for the Labour Party, according to most media coverage, should be zero. Starmer's personal popularity is historically low. It's absolutely appalling. But the actual party of government is still doing better than anybody would believe if they were basing their views on what they're being told by most of the media. Thank you. That was a brilliant call, David. Absolutely brilliant. It's given me lots of food for thought. Not a lot of hope, but certainly a lot of food for thought. It's 10:48. Phone lines are open.
Tonight with Andrew Marr from 6 p.m.
A big speech today, surrounded by a hubbub of suggestions, fears, leaks and a general hysteria about the coming budget. But in an exclusive interview with the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, you will get the very latest tonight in her own words. Join me, Andrew Marr, at 6.
Tonight with Andrew Marr from 6 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Oh, recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
It's the last chance to get yourself a ticket for Wednesday's Lotto draw.
It could be you.
Lotto from the National Lottery. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
A Thames Link train is a place where you can have more me time. A chance to skip traffic and glide to wherever you need to be. With headspace to focus on more important matters. Like if that cloud is a starfish or sunflower. Fast journeys without the rush with great deals at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanas to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe. Only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Drop up on island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours to. I. Inspect tire your pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Think, do the 4-trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
Where does it end, I wonder? I mean, do we just sit here listening to people telling us to stop talking about the major contributors to our fiscal situation for 50 years? Or, I mean, at what point does it actually become true that you can't track back where we are now to what we did under the ABC of British politics? Austerity, Brexit, COVID. The answer to almost every question about why things are so bad. Austerity, Brexit, COVID. And not just the inevitable impact of COVID, but the appalling mismanagement that left us losing more lives and more money than we needed to. While, of course, some people got very, very, very rich. Spoiler alert, all Tories. But here we are. With their friends in the media now attacking Rachel Reeves. For what, exactly? I don't know. 10:52 is the time. I have a multiple choice question for you. A Kent County Council is not going to put up Christmas lights this year. As things stand, unless something changes, a county council in Kent, controlled by Reform UK, is not putting up Christmas lights this year, and I want you to tell me why. Is it A, because of the offence it will cause to non-Christians? Is it B, because of the light pollution, the danger that it poses to motorists and wildlife? Or is it C, because all the lampposts are covered in flags? So why is a Reform UK County Council currently poised not to put up Christmas lights at this wonderful time of year? Is it A, for fear of offending non-Christians, a kind of winterval, if you will? Is it B, for environmental reasons, light pollution and the impact upon local wildlife, who can get tangled up in the lights, like pigeons, but also squirrels? Or is it C, because all of the lampposts are covered in tatty old flags? A, B or C? Why won't Reform UK councils, in this case, be celebrating Christmas properly in Kent? It might be quite easy, that one. I don't know. But let's see what you think. 10:53 is the time. Simon is in Preston. What's going on, Simon?
Well, first of all, it's C.
Spoil sport. Actually, let's not move on. Let's just pause for a moment to reflect upon that almost unbelievably delicious irony. What's that you've done? Oh, we've ruined Christmas. Why? Oh, all the flags that we've stuck on lampposts. You just couldn't make it up, could you? So you've got to take the flags down, which is, of course, what the people who put them up wanted all along, because then when they got taken down, they could shout nonsense about patriotism and British values. But we can't put up... We can't put up the Christmas lights until the flags have been put down. And the leader of Kent County Council once vowed not to remove the flags put up unilaterally by the people of Kent. So it's almost as if these people are blithering idiots. But on we go. Back to Labour.
Sorry, I can't think now. You've made me laugh too much.
Oh, sorry.
Now, I think.
Why now? Why is she doing it now? ABC, austerity, Brexit, COVID. It's 14 months since they got into, 16 months since they got into.
Yeah, they should have done it immediately. I don't know why they didn't, because for my sins, James, I have to pick up a Daily Mail most days when I'm at work, because I'm a carer, and I take a paper to somebody. And the headlines.
That's not very caring.
but this guy believes everything he reads. And he's an intelligent person, but he's just like he believes everything he reads. And it's an absolute comic. You know, no matter what they do, they vehemently hate whatever. If you know,
yes, of course. It's a very well-designed business model. They know exactly what it's doing. Long before algorithms invaded our lives in a technological sense, the editorial input on a newspaper like that was very, very carefully calibrated to make people angry and frightened. And, of course, to protect wealth. And the bigger the wealth, the bigger the need for protection.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, I don't mind Keir Starmer as a person. I think he's probably a thoroughly decent person. But one of his problems, he just... changes direction, and he's trying to be a people pleaser. And in this situation,
some people would argue the opposite. You know, they'd say the last fella did. He's not trying hard enough to demonstrate empathy. I know that's not the same as people pleasing, but it's in the same ballpark.
I think he has empathy. But unfortunately, and I think he's probably a really decent bloke, but he cannot communicate that.
No.
He can't, and I think also he's surrounded by people who are, you know, like that dreadful thing about, you know, a thing of strangers. That was, why did he come out with that? You know, it's just like bonkers.
But they're trying to lance
bonkers.
The boil of bigotry by essentially telling the boil that they have that it has legitimate concerns, which is never going to work, and it gets them into more trouble than they...
I think the only thing they can do... They've been voted in for, they've got three and a bit years left. You just have to get your head down, ignore the stuff that's flying around your heads, and you've just got to press on with what you've got to do. But also, you've got to sing like a canary from the rooftops at every opportunity of our success. We've done this for you, we're doing this for you, we're doing this for you. And it's the only way it's going to do it. No point harping back to Brexit. It's done. And you just got to get on with it and just sell the positives, not looking back at the negatives.
No, I mean, you can do both, but listen, mate, if you're building a house because someone burnt it down, and you think that you should stop mentioning the fact that somebody burnt it down...
No, I agree with you.
Then you're bonkers.
I agree with you. I completely agree with you on that, but the fact of the matter is, that's the situation. That 15 years of mismanagement has totally...
Maybe you're right. Maybe, I mean, not so much that you refocus, but I mean, the earlier caller who said it was Chris in Bedford, they're never going to admit what they've done.
Not.
You're never going to get a speech. I mean, you will eventually have a Tory leader who is calling for us to rejoin the European Union, but not in a hot minute.
Yeah, yeah. So
what are we waiting for?
I'm not in disagreement with you. You just got to get on with it now. This is where we are. And
it's not either or. She can't do a budget without talking about the reasons why she has to do this.
I agree to a certain point with that. But the situation, and no matter what they're going to say, they're going to be attacked, aren't they? They're just going to be attacked.
Yes.
It's just not just situation.
They're not good faith attacks. That's the bit I can't remember. Is whether or not in government, not in opposition, because the arithmetic is different, and, you know, patriotism should demand that even if we're being governed by a party you don't like or people you haven't warmed to, you want them to do well, because that way the national interest lies. I appreciate that's very hard to observe and probably a little bit naive to dream of, but I don't know what it was like. I mean, I don't think Tony Blair had this level of hostility directed at him from day one. Maybe he did. Didn't Jeremy Clarkson call Gordon Brown a one-eyed Scottish idiot at some point, which suggests that the current vitriol is nothing new? But I don't know, is the short answer. And yet I do know that the closest we came to consensus in that hour is that they are not getting any messages across, except perhaps the one that Rachel Reeves got across today about the ABC, austerity, Brexit, COVID, the ABC of what's wrong with Britain. Why aren't they using that as a line? We came up with that this morning. Andrea pointed it out. I've evolved it slightly. The ABC of what's wrong with Britain. Austerity, Brexit, COVID. And we're here to fix it. There you go. You can have that for nothing, lads. 3 weeks from now, I want to hear that in the budget. We're here. It's as easy as ABC. Might be a little bit too complicated for the party opposite, but for the rest of us, nothing is simpler. ABC.
On your radio. On the LBC app. And
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the Chancellor has given her clearest indication yet that taxes will rise in the budget later this month. In a speech from Downing Street this morning, Rachel Reeves warned that everyone must do their bit. She blamed an uncertain world, lower productivity rates and the welfare bill for the hard choices that she'll have to make. Miss Reeves also said that she'll do what's necessary to secure and protect families from high inflation.
When I was appointed Chancellor, people put their faith in me to take our country forward. Not to be swayed by political convenience. Not to always do what is popular, but to do what is right.
Opposition parties have been reacting to the speech by the Chancellor. The Liberal Democrats say it suggests that the budget will be a bitter pill to swallow, while the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says it was a masterclass in managed decline.
The Chancellor's speech was one long waffle bomb. A laundry list of excuses. She blamed absolutely everybody else for her own choices, her own decisions, her own failures.
The FTSE 100 dropped more than 100 points following the Chancellor's speech. A short time ago, the index was at 96.01. The pound has also fallen to $1.30 and €1.13. Rachel Reeves will be speaking exclusively to Tonight with Andrew Marr here on LBC from 6 o'clock tonight. In other news this morning, protesters could be jailed for up to 6 months for demonstrating outside the homes of MPs and other politicians under a new law. It follows a survey carried out by the Commons Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, which found that 96% of MPs had experienced some form of harassment. The reforms are due to be set out in the Crime and Policing Bill, which is making its way through Parliament. Online pornography, which shows women being choked, will be banned under planned legislation as part of government efforts to tackle violence against women and girls. Sir Alan Bates has reportedly settled his compensation claim over the Post Office Horizon scandal. The former sub-postmaster has been leading a fight for justice for victims for more than 20 years. It's understood Sir Alan has reached a seven-figure deal with the government. And Sir David Beckham will receive his knighthood at a ceremony at Windsor Castle today. The former England captain is being honoured for his services to sport and charity. LBC weather, wet and windy for much of England and Wales today. Drier for northern Scotland and the south of England. Feeling very mild, though. A high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
3 minutes after 11, a quick glance in the rearview mirror. Steve actually points out something I should have spotted a little bit sooner, is that if she had gone earlier, Rachel Reeves, on ABC, the reasons why we're in such a mess, despite, I love the idea that Kemi Badenoch thinks that Rachel Reeves is somehow responsible for austerity, Brexit, and the Conservatives' mishandling of COVID. I've got to give her credit for something. I'm not sure what, but you've got to give her credit for something. But Steve points out, if she had gone earlier, it would have looked like she was blaming 52% of the electorate for the mess. And in a way, she is. I am. It's entirely your fault. Contempt for the con men, compassion for the con. But what a ridiculous country we've become when terrible things are done to all of us by some people, and not only do they waltz away scot-free, they tell the rest of us that we should stop talking about the terrible things they've done. Simon Marks with me at 11:45, if like me you are enjoying, if that's the right word, his regular, increasingly regular bulletins from Donald Trump's United States. It is the election of the mayor of New York, the next mayor of New York today, and already various lies. He's a communist, apparently, according to Donald Trump. It's a little rule of thumb for people on the right of politics, the right of politics. Whenever they use the word communist, they're telling you that they don't know what the word communist means, or if they do, they're lying. Also key races in Virginia and New Jersey, which could have wider ramifications. So we will look forward to speaking to Simon. A complete change of pace first, though. Oh, actually, I'll just finish Steve's message. Looking forward to seeing you and Gary in February. I bought it as a Christmas present for my wife, as she adores Gary. What am I, chopped liver? Honestly. But it's more for me. That is top presenting there. Come and see James O'Brien and Gary Lineker on stage in London in February. But buy it as a present for your partner, even though you are going to enjoy it at least as much as they are. What a double bubble. Tickets are moving fast, so you may want to get your skates on if you want to join me, Gary Lineker, and Steve and his wife on stage in London in February. Details are, of course, on the LBC website and, indeed, the all-new LBC app. OK, how long have you been listening to this nonsense? How many years, I mean? Not how many minutes. How many years? I don't think it's unhealthy for me to point out to you occasionally, or even sometimes some weeks, quite often, how much we've changed. How some subjects used to bring out the worst in me. And the tricky bit, you know, is, I don't know if it makes good radio. Is that the right phrase to use? But we, all of us who are good at this job, have a slightly performative element to some of our opinions. So I think with me, most obviously, it was with vegetarians and obesity, when I would almost revel in what I thought was quite a comical cruelty. But of course, when you meet people who are not seeing anything comical in your cruelty, if you're a decent person, or if you at least try to be a decent person, you will give your head a wobble. And you will change the way that you speak about obesity, and you will change the way that you speak about vegetarianism. And you don't need me to give you a list of people who, on those particular issues, especially oddly vegetarianism, they think they're being comically cruel, and a lot of us may laugh along with it, but you're causing utterly unnecessary upset to people who've done absolutely nothing wrong except trying to live a good life. Or, in the case of obesity, people who've done absolutely nothing wrong except fall under the spell of an eating disorder or of other health issues. I think one of the key points for me on the obesity issue was when you said to me, would you mock somebody with anorexia in the same way that you're mocking somebody who is obese because of an eating disorder? And I obviously said, no, of course I wouldn't. I'm going to stop. And it might seem an odd cohort to add to the list. It might seem a really odd cohort to add to the list. And that's why I ask how long you've been listening to this program. Because if I tell you that I used to go in very, very hard on women having home births, then you may not actually believe me. Because it seems so at odds with the time we spend together now, that you would have focused on this particular category of human as somebody who deserved a bit of a roasting. But I did. And I want to return to the topic today. And I am still of the same opinion, up to a point, that the option of having a home birth for the NHS and maternity services in their current state is suboptimal. In an ideal world, you should be able to have your baby in whatever circumstances you want. But the number of stories involving complicated, complex pregnancies and even in some cases terrible conclusions to attempted home births suggest to me that the system, either the system is unfit for purpose in many areas, or it shouldn't. But look, this is what I mean. I used to have no qualms. This is what I mean by a sort of element of performative cruelty. I used to have no qualms whatsoever at this point in this introduction. I'm going back now 15 years because it was when I became a parent, when we became parents, that I found my attention drawn to this because so many of our circle and our peer group, our contemporaries, were going through the same thing as well. And I mean, all three of the people I knew that wanted to have home birth ended up in hospital. They ended up being taken to hospital by ambulance halfway through their home birth. And I didn't used to hesitate to be a little bit rude. And I don't want to be rude now. And I don't know whether it'll work as a phone-in if I'm not a bit rude. I you know, like when we do vegetarianism and someone rings up to tell me a psychopathic corpse eater. Was it a psychopathic corpse eater or a corpse muncher? It was eater, wasn't it? A psychopathic corpse eater. I wouldn't have got that call, which was good radio, if I hadn't been rude, if I hadn't pushed a button. So I don't know. I'm not going to go back to being rude, particularly not about women dealing with something as sensitive as how they want to give birth. But if I'm not rude, will the conversation land in the same way, with the same power that it landed when I was rude? This, I grant you, is this is a little bit self-indulgent, this introduction, but I am never anything less than honest with you, and that is where my mind is at the moment. I want to have this conversation, but I don't know if I'm going to push your buttons when I have it, as I'm about to, in a largely very polite fashion. So the rudest word I'm going to use is selfish. Is it selfish to want a home birth in the world we inhabit? I'm going to go all Rachel Reeves for a bit. In the world we inhabit, not the world we want to inhabit. So in a world where access to safe, reliable and unrestricted home birth services is patchy and varies enormously depending on where people live. Worldwide, maternity services are seeing an increase in the number of women with more complex pregnancies. Many choosing to have their babies in a familiar environment. Some choosing a home birth because their first baby being born in hospital was deeply traumatic and they don't want to repeat the experience, but it causes problems. It causes all sorts of problems, up to and including women losing their lives after things go wrong. One newspaper, The Guardian in this case, has spoken to doctors, academics and pregnancy experts about home births after a coroner's court in Rochdale ruled that a mother and a daughter died after a home birth owing to a gross failure to provide basic medical care. It's a horrific story. It involves midwives who had worked 12-hour shifts before delivering this baby. They had both been awake for more than 30 hours by the time the delivery was over. They tried their best, but they had a lack of understanding and confidence in what the mother wanted because there'd been a failure of communication from others. And it just seems to me that all of those possibilities grow when you decide that you want to have your baby at home. And that's what I want to talk about. And I want to do it honestly, and I want to do it politely, but I am still coming from a point where I think it's selfish. Do you? 0345 6060973. Unless you've got some really powerful arguments for me, I think we should be encouraging as many people as possible to have their babies in hospital. Whether or not we remove entirely the option of having a baby at home, which removes staff from a hospital. I just can't see a way through this that doesn't lead to the conclusion that it's well, at the very least, it's a luxury that we can't currently afford because of the costs and indeed the personnel factors. But also, it's one that even if we could afford it, we probably shouldn't be doing because it just complicates something that's already going to be quite fraught. Listen, straightforward births. doesn't matter where they happen. But the knowledge that it's not going to be, not necessarily going to be straightforward, should perhaps be a reason why we encourage as many women as possible to have their babies in hospital. They need clearer warnings. Women need clearer warnings on the dangers of home births, is the headline on the story that I'm looking at, say experts. So there is a broad consensus that women are not sufficiently aware of the risks, to which I respond by wondering why you're allowed to do it at all, given that these risks are both real, considerable, and we learn, not fully appreciated. Okay? You can be rude to me this hour, but I'm not going to be rude to you. I'm not going to be any ruder than selfish, all right? I'm just going to say it just seems, well, maybe not even selfish. Is it self-indulgent? Is there a better word to describe what I'm describing? 0345 6060 973. I'm not going to be rude to you or about you. I'm going to try not to be. I don't want to be, but you're allowed to be rude to me. But should home birth in 2025 in the United Kingdom, should it be an option? And I don't think it should. I really don't think it should. It should be something that is done with the easiest and quickest possible access to emergency care in the event, the very likely event of an emergency unfolding. Now, I am not going to confine this conversation to women, because I do think that we sometimes suffer from forgetting that the birth is a consequence of two people's actions, and that, all being well, two people will be responsible for every aspect of child care, albeit that one may shoulder the burden, may shoulder the lion's share of that burden. It is something that both people, and I'm particularly aware of situations where dad doesn't want a home birth, but mum does. And the reason why dad doesn't want a home birth is because he's conscious of what can go wrong. That's not an argument I'd ever like to be part of in the context of my own marriage, which happily is never going to happen now, but it could have done back in the day. What's that like when one of you wants it and one of you doesn't? So I'm not confining the conversation to women, and I'm not confining the conversation to medical professionals. I think it's a social issue, and therefore we've all got a view on this. But I am interested particularly in hearing, at least in the first or second instance, from midwives or maternity nurses, from people who work in the sector, on what I've got wrong, or indeed, because it does happen sometimes, what I've got right. 0345 6060 973 is the number that you need. Given the possible dangers and the obvious hazards of not being in a place where emergencies are routinely dealt with, why would you want to do this? Is another question I'd ask. And I ask that very honestly. Why would you want to do this? It always struck me as deeply strange. You know, I'm going to have a baby at home. Okay, well, what if... I know it's not technically a medical procedure in the way that other things are, but you wouldn't, you wouldn't have an operation in your kitchen, so why would you give birth in your sitting room? Question. And that's as rude as I'm going to get. And if it means that it's not as exciting in terms of our conversation, then that is a price I am willing to pay for not offending you unnecessarily. Call me a snowflake. It's 11:17.
This is LBC.
Train to Chichester. Flasks filled, snacks packed, all ready for Maisie's first stargazing adventure.
Come on, Maisie. Follow everyone up to the top of that hill.
Oh, look. That one's the plough.
Shooting star. Oh, wow.
Oh, made it. Last train back and feeling cosmic. And it seems we have an astronaut in the making. Download the Southern Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story.
It's that time of year again, which can only mean one thing. Save a third off roasting joints at Waitrose. Choose from tender beef silverside, succulent whole brined and seasoned chicken, or juicy beach smoked gammon. So, fire up your ovens and give winter a warm welcome with a third off roasting joints. Waitrose, the home of food lovers.
Selected lines and stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands, Little Waitrose and Partners and Concessions. Offer ends 11th of November.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Oh, recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it. And there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
11:18 is the time. If men could have babies, you wouldn't be having this phone-in about home births to begin with. If men could give birth, they would have every option open to them. Good grief, you write. And people ask why women are so angry. Blimey. I don't know if that's true, but I am happy to read out the criticism. And this from a man. I have strong views on home birth based on my wife's experience of dealing with the aftermath of them when they have gone wrong. She is a doctor. Such sad stories, says Warren, but that is all I want to say on the matter. And in many ways, that covers my perspective. It covers my angle on perhaps the strangeness of it. And that thing when you're in that zone of what your options are, and just thinking, I want to be in a hospital in case something goes wrong. That's all. That's all. Why don't you? Vicky's in Northampton. Vicky, what would you like to say?
Oh, good morning, James.
Hello, Vicky.
I'm calling because I used to work as a midwife. I should put it out there that I haven't worked as a midwife for well over 10 years.
Okay.
But the challenges that women and midwives face in terms of understanding and managing and responding to those risks is part of the reason that I left the service all those years ago. I was a community-based midwife with a caseload of women, got to know my women really well, supported a good number of them to have really straightforward, uneventful home births.
Right.
But like you say, a number of them don't go according to plan, and the backup really needs to be there when you need it. And I've been personally in situations where that backup hasn't been there.
Which is an impossible situation to be in. And in many ways, you've highlighted my slightly painstaking attempt to be diplomatic on this, because I'm not asking if in an ideal world we shouldn't be having them. I'm asking if in the world that we inhabit, and albeit that you haven't been in the job for 10 years, if I've understood you correctly, you didn't feel it was necessarily responsible to encourage women to go down this path because of the lack of support and understanding that was there.
But I think you have to balance that against women's reasons for choosing a home birth in the first place. If they choose to pursue a home birth, they're much more likely to know the team of midwives that look after them.
Right.
And that personal relationship is hugely important, that support during labour. Not that they don't get that same support in labour from hospital-based midwives, but that relationship, that really knowing somebody really well, is hugely important in labour. And you're much more likely to get that from your own midwife or from a small team of midwives at a home birth than you are in a hospital. And you need to look at how many women have experienced traumatic births in hospital.
Yes, of course.
Where their birth plan hasn't gone as they'd, you know, their birth hasn't gone according to their birth plan. And their reasons, therefore, their motivations for choosing those home births. It's really difficult, even as a midwife who'd recently left the service when I had my own second baby, having had a complicated birth the first time, and with all of my knowledge and experience, it's hugely difficult to advocate for your own wants and wishes, but not just your wants and wishes, but what you know to be safe and evidence-based against a system that, you know, isn't built to listen to you. And that's why women are choosing home births from a team of midwives that they know and trust.
You're covering a lot of ground, forgive me, and I'm sure this is my fault. I'm not 100% clear on why you left the service.
So I left the service because we weren't able to deliver safe and effective care to women.
In home births?
Well, not just in home
births. But across the whole sector?
The whole service, So as an example, I would work sort of 8:30 till 5 as my normal working day. I'd then be on call. I might get home, be cooking dinner, get called back to the birth centre, then go home sort of late evening or in the night, then get called out to a home birth. And I'd be working 24 plus hours straight if we had to then transfer somebody into a hospital for whatever reason, either mum or baby, because things can go wrong unexpectedly, then you're then waiting around for transport to take you back to your vehicle. But then you've got calls saying, but you've got your antenatal clinic that you need to cover today.
Holy moly.
So it is, and that was all those years ago. And I don't believe that the service is any better staffed now than it was when I left the service.
No, and I understand why you left. And so you'll be less surprised than anybody when you read about midwives in one of the recent tragic cases, having worked 12-hour shifts and having been awake before they delivered the baby in this case, and they'd been awake for more than 30 hours. So that's the point, isn't it? It's 90% context, this conversation. In the context of the system that is in place, or was in place when you were in the job, and it's unlikely to have changed much since, surely the wise advice would be to do it in a hospital just in case. Even with the negatives and the suboptimal situations in hospitals, if something goes wrong, you want to be in a hospital, don't you?
I think it's context dependent.
Okay.
I've supported so many women through really beautiful, uneventful, straightforward home births, and they've been lovely experiences both for me and for not just that woman but her whole family that are there. But it can and it does go wrong, and I think
if it goes wrong, you're going to be better off in hospital, aren't you?
If it goes wrong, you are going to be better off in hospital.
And you make many, many brilliant points, and perhaps a little clumsily, or I'm being a bit of a sledgehammer rather than a scalpel. That for me is close to being a deal breaker. If something goes wrong, you're going to be better off in hospital. But how many of us want to go into that fearing the worst? I don't know. I mean, that's why it's so interesting. Vicky, you're the perfect opener on this conversation. Thank you so much. 25 minutes after 11 is the time. Some breaking news for you. Dick Cheney, the 46th Vice President of the United States, died last night at the age of 84. Survived by, and indeed in the company of, his wife Lynn and his daughters Liz and Mary, as well as other family members when he passed. Former Vice President, who served, of course, under George W. Bush, died due to complications of pneumonia and cardiac and vascular disease. 25 minutes after 11 is the time. And in post, of course, during the Second Gulf War, when relations between the United Kingdom and the United States of America, for good or for ill, were crucial. Simon Marks, no doubt, will have something to say about the passing of Dick Cheney when he joins us in about 20 minutes' time. Until then, home births. And given that, if something goes wrong, you will be immeasurably better off in a hospital. Why wouldn't you start off in the hospital in the first place? Megan's in Guildford. Megan, what would you like to say?
Hi there.
Hello.
I think the kind of key bit of information that's missing in the conversation as it's happening at the moment is the kind of very, very thorough research that has been done into the safety of home birth, particularly for women with uncomplicated pregnancies, that has shown kind of immeasurably that the rates of intervention and complication are significantly lower when women are giving birth out of hospital than when they are giving birth in hospital. In terms of what data this is based on, there's an enormous study, if anyone wants to look it up, in the Lancet, which looked at 500,000 births that actually happened, comparing women that intended to give birth at home to women that intended to give birth in hospital. And the rates of unplanned cesarean, severe tearing, instrumental birth are all lower when women are planning to give birth out of hospital.
Of course. I mean, they will be, because in a well-run system, it will only be healthy women with a low-risk pregnancy, and ideally who've had an uncomplicated birth before, who would be encouraged to do home births. But what today's report discovers or detects is that is no longer the case. You will not be given the information that you need to make the choice that fits with the statistics you cite. Evidence that home birth carries higher risks for babies, particularly for first-time mothers or those with high-risk pregnancies, exists. That's Professor Asma Khalil, the consultant obstetrician and a renowned expert in maternal and fetal medicine. Mm. So I that's the problem, isn't it? And in a system that is underfunded and under-resourced, it just feels like a luxury that we can't necessarily afford.
I mean, the data around safety for home births for first-time mums is significantly out of date from 2011 and the 2022 paper from the Lancet.
Well, I'm just quoting the obstetrician
and expert in
maternal and fetal evidence about the risks of home birth. So of course, the massive majority happily go swimmingly. And of course, when the system is working properly and the only women who are encouraged or even perhaps permitted to go down that road are the ones who will be by definition low risk, then we haven't got a problem. But that's not the system that we're living under. That's not the system that we're living in. There are problems routinely, and a lot of women who are not low risk are opting for this because the information available to them is poor. That's what today's report is about. That's what the entire report has been designed to address. So in a nutshell, take as long as you want. Well, I'm going to be late for the news. What is the impulse? What's the key impulse for going down this path when there is a sort of logic, even if it's a bit cold, to the idea that if I'm doing something that's potentially hazardous, I want to be in the best possible place in the event of something hazardous happening? What's the tension between the two positions?
The difficulty I think that women have when they're making this decision is that their definition of where they feel to be the safest is different from perhaps your definition or perhaps some of the kind of maternity care professionals.
But in terms of my definition, it's safety dependent upon a medical emergency.
Yes. Yeah, but other people will define emotional safety or their physical safety will be defined in a different way because they feel that being outside of hospital is going to protect them in other ways that hospital may potentially cause them harm. And that's the issue that we've got in maternity services at the moment, is that there is such a lack of trust between women and maternity services. Why? Because women are being severely harmed every single day at the hands of maternity services. And I want to be very clear that this is not at the hands of individual clinicians, midwives or obstetricians, but as a service that is set up to not meet their needs and not meet the needs of the staff that are working within the system either.
Okay. So you fear what would happen to you at the hands of maternity staff in a hospital, but not at home?
I believe some women would, yes. And okay. I know I support thousands of women every year in this position, and a lot of them do feel that the care that they receive at home is going to be better for them than the care that
that's part of the problem, isn't it? It's why it's such a sensitive subject, because of course feelings are hugely important in contexts like this. But I don't know quite how you end up persuading yourself that in the event of a medical emergency, you're going to be better off in your sitting room than you are in the heart of a hospital. I just don't. But again, as you say, if people feel that they are going to be, then that's going to be a very difficult position to challenge. Thank you, Megan. Dominic Ellis is here with your headlines.
Some breaking news this hour. The former Republican US Vice President Dick Cheney has died at the age of 84. He served under George W. Bush for two terms between 2001 and 2009. We'll bring you more on this story in the LBC News Bulletin at midday. The Chancellor has repeatedly refused to rule out tax rises in the budget later this month. In a speech from Downing Street this morning, Rachel Reeves warned each of us must do our bit. And the far-right activist Tommy Robinson has been acquitted of a terror offence after refusing to give police his phone passcode. The request was made as part of an inspection at the Channel Tunnel last year. LBC weather, wet and windy for much of England and Wales today. Drier for northern Scotland and the south of England. Feeling very mild, a high of 17 degrees.
This is LBC.
A southern train is a place where family moments become more peaceful. Where you can spread out and a game of I Spy gets a scenic upgrade with snacks, stories and the occasional sheep for a bonus point. Less stress, more yes, with kids' tickets for £2 at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year, every year for career development. Like Juliet, she's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest, You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about Pension Credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension Credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling and the whole world smiles with you.
BanningDental.co.uk.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 33 minutes after 11, and I was just saying to Eleanor in the break, I don't recognise the person that I used to be when I would conduct conversations like this one in a fairly obnoxious fashion, like being rude. Perhaps I'd have been rude to Megan, the last caller. It's just strange in such sensitive territory to have prioritised the strength of your own opinions over anything else. And the reason why I'm being so, or trying, because I may not be succeeding, I acknowledge that, sensitive, is some ways contained within this message from Anthony. I'm getting triggered here, James. My eldest child is in a wheelchair and severely disabled because the NCT told us that pregnancy is being over-medicalised. It'll be a slightly more complicated story than that, but of course that notion that there's anywhere, in the case of a medical emergency, that there's anywhere better to be than a hospital, to me, is a large part of the answer to the question of home births. But of course, for an awful lot of people, the knowledge or the confidence that there isn't going to be any medical emergency is a large part of the reason why you would opt for a home birth. So it may just be one of those ones where never the twain shall meet. But it becomes then about resources and whether or not the system is fit for purpose. And this piece today that I'm drawing on suggests that in many areas it isn't. It's about 1 in 50 in England and Wales now take place at home. Home births are recommended only for low-risk pregnancies, but some people, including the tragic case that has been in the news recently, are quite high-risk. I guess you can't really be stopped from doing it. The widower of the woman whose case you will be familiar with, Jennifer Cahill, told the court that the dangers of a home birth had not been fully explained to them. Phrases such as out of guidance were favoured rather than against medical advice, and the risk of death was not explicitly raised. So it is a lot more complicated than some of our contributions allow, but there it is. Darren is in Basingstoke. Darren, what would you like to say?
Hello, mate. How you doing?
Very well. What's on your mind?
So my second daughter was born at home. We were told, because my wife, they said she had quite a standard firstborn, was all good in hospital. They said, no, you're a good case to have a home birth.
Yeah. So, why did you fancy it? Why did you both fancy that?
I think it's because, you know, birthing pool.
Yeah.
Midwives were up for it. They said, yeah, not a problem. They come and done the survey, set the birthing pool up, all good.
Yeah.
She had a 4-hour labour with her first child, so they said, no need to come in hospital because hospital's busy, this, okay, that and the other.
Yeah.
So that day came, midwives turned up, she was born. I didn't like her breathing. I said this to the midwives. Both midwives had over 40 years experience between them.
Right.
And they said, no, don't panic, she's fine. So right. It's just, you know, she's just coming out, you know, new to the world and everything else.
Yeah.
Following morning, had a restless night, and then my wife decided about 7 o'clock in the morning to do a drop test because we didn't like...
What's that? What's a drop test?
So basically you hold the baby and you slightly drop her.
Yeah.
And she reacts like arms out, legs out.
Okay, right, okay.
And
I think I remember that actually. Yeah,
yeah, she done nothing and... Oh. Then she rapidly turned blue. Rapidly turned blue. So I phoned the doctors because they were 2 minutes around the corner and they basically turned around. This seems funny now, but they turned around and said, you can't bring it here because we're a place of medical treatment and they won't prioritise an ambulance. Just phone 999.
Right.
Phone 999. Couldn't get an ambulance. So we drove her to our Basingstoke Hospital, which is about 5 miles away. With my four-year-old in the back telling me, but she's still breathing. I dropped him off outside the front of the hospital.
So mum runs in with baby.
With baby. Her mum worked at the hospital at the time, so she met her at reception. Run her up. By the time I run in, she's gone into cardiac arrest. And where they told us to go was the daycare unit. They were waiting for us outside maternity, which we got told by the doctor the wrong place to go.
Okay.
She spent 2 hours being resuscitated in a... basically a triage room.
Right.
The only thing that saved her life was on that day, in the daycare centre, there was two paediatric consultants in there doing an audit, which saved her life.
They were just there.
Priya and Nick spent 2 hours resuscitating her.
Well played, I love that.
And then they called Southampton Paediatric Intensive Care Unit, and they sent up an ambulance with a crash team. And she had a police escort down to Southampton, where they put on 19 machines. We were told that her life wasn't viable because her pH was 6.4.
Right.
So she was on nitric acid. She had 9 EV pumps into her, bear hugger and everything else. She was in there for 5 days. And even the doctor consultant come up and said, look, I'm going to be honest, she's less than 50%. She's going to survive. And if she does survive, she's going to have brain damage because, she was pretty bad. So she spent 5 days in paediatric intensive care unit. They brought her out of a coma and they had the crash team there waiting. And they said, she might just go straight into cardiac arrest again because what was happening, she was all lined up down her throat and everything else.
Yeah.
Very much, she weighed 7 pounds, 8 ounces. They extubated her and within 25 minutes of extubating her, she was breastfeeding with mum. she had another turn at 9 years old where she had a polyontopic seizure, and she had to be juiced back into coma again. She had lumbar punch and everything else, but she's now a beautiful 16-year-old.
And healthy.
She's got short-term memory loss, which is they think was due to the amount of oxygen she was lost from, and all the drugs they pumped into her.
Yeah.
But other than that, she's had everything. So on the first year she was born, she had swine flu, chicken pox at Christmas. She was born in February, so by Christmas she's already had swine flu and chicken pox when that was prevalent. Everything just bounces off her. She's absolutely unreal. They said she's still on the hospital sort of admitted a little bit of liability, so she's on a special thing because she's 21.
Of course.
She's the most beautiful 16-year-old, and her name's Kitty Hope. Big shout out to Southampton Paediatric Intensive Care Unit, which I'm now a trustee of. So we do all that and do a lot of work for them, but they've got like 15 beds down there, and it's all, it's an amazing unit. And it's Great Ormond Street, Southampton Paediatric Intensive Care Unit, John Radcliffe and Bristol are the four kids' units that cover the South.
It's a crash course you never want to go on, isn't it, really?
No.
But you did, and you're here to tell the story happily.
So if you ever see an ambulance with a grey elephant with a pink bandage around its head and a baby in its arms, that is a PICU ambulance, and they're special paediatric intensive care ambulances.
I didn't know that.
There's not many of them about, and they are a very special team. The guy that saved Kitty and the team, they can actually carry out heart surgery at 80 miles an hour on a motorway.
Holy moly.
If needed be. They can do anything. They're amazing.
I know why you've rung in, because it's a conversation about home birth, but
yes.
And that obviously would have weighed on your mind at the time.
Yeah. We was persuaded. We didn't,
I hear you.
And then they said, no, you're sure case to have home birth, and then it was the home, the pool and everything, and it was all really going well, and then it went downhill very, very rapidly, and it still plays on our minds that we had the home birth, because they said if she'd have been in hospital, we'd have picked that up. You wouldn't have had to pick it up because you were trying to deal with having a new baby, but because obviously as soon as the midwives delivered her, they'd gone. There was no one watching over the baby, whereas they said if she was in hospital, they would have been monitoring all the stats. And that would have basically happened. She had a condition called PPHM, which is persistent pulmonary hypertension in a newborn,
right.
Which basically means when she came out of mum, her valve in her heart didn't flick over, so she suffocated.
Oh, mate.
No one noticed it, but it's a slow thing, because it's a slow valve turnover, because they're getting used to coming out of mum.
And these are hen's teeth scenarios, but yes. It's a human condition, Darren. And some of us are built in a way that thinks, well, just in case it's a hen's teeth scenario, I want to be in hospital. Yeah. And other people are built in a way that thinks it's never going to happen to us. I want to do it at home. And I don't know that we can ever build a bridge between those two positions.
No,
and we don't need to. I'll tell you what, though. Andy speaks for an awful lot of people when he says, I've never been so relieved as to get to the end of a story and discover that it's a happy ending. You had us all on tenterhooks there, mate. I don't know whether you did that on purpose.
No, I say we had the chaplain in because they said, there's nothing we can do. So we had the chaplain come up. She was in tears.
Mm.
And then basically they stuck about five lines in her, pumped her full of adrenaline and everything else. All the drugs that you hear that are not good, they have to pump her with them.
Yeah.
She's still got the scars from that as well.
I'm sure.
But she's just as strong as an ox.
That's magnificent. Kitty Hope. Lovely
Kitty
stuff.
Kitty Hope, yes.
Well played, mate.
Anyone who's got any spare cash, Friends of PICU, they cover the whole country for paediatric.
Go on, say that again. Friends of what?
So it's Friends of PICU.
PICU.
Yeah, paediatric intensive care unit.
Okay.
And they've got like a grey elephant it's got a pink bandage.
I'm going to chuck you. I'll chuck a few quid in there after the show, mate.
Brilliant.
And I hope other people do as well. Take care. What a lovely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And of course, it doesn't cancel out in any way all of the perfectly happy and trauma-free experiences of home birth. But I think that's actually the nutshell, isn't it, is that for some of us, just because we're built, that would be the tiny risk is still one I don't want to take, whereas for other people, the tiny risk is a reason why you would do it, because the risk is tiny, and perhaps never the twain shall meet. Thank you, Darren. Apologies to everybody waiting to talk about this, Josh and Gemma, Rebecca and Rachel. Are we going to get another alliteration? No, we're not. Steve and Lucy. Spoiled it for all of us at the end there. Speaking of names, the rail worker credited with saving multiple lives during that mass stabbing on the Doncaster to London King's Cross service on Saturday evening. His actions described as nothing short of heroic has been named. And his name is Samir Zitouni.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why is there delay?
Straight to the point.
This government is unravelling everywhere you look.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
How can that make sense to anyone?
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe. Only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
When you buy a BMW approved used electric car, there are no surprises. You'll find the largest range and the widest choice. Naturally, every car has been meticulously checked by qualified BMW technicians. Hardly a plot twist. And they always come with a battery health report and at least 12 months unlimited mileage BMW warranty. Just as you'd expect. BMW approved used electric cars. Nothing new here. Search BMW approved used electric. Obviously.
Hillary's best ever Black Friday sale is now on, and it doesn't get any better than this, with an extra 10% off absolutely everything. That's on top of up to 50% off hundreds of made-to-measure blinds, curtains and shutters. Plus, control your blinds from anywhere with a half-price smart hub when you buy any electric blind, with measuring and fitting always included. And word to the window wise. Order now for blinds and curtains fitted in time for Christmas. Book your free in-home appointment today at hillarys.co.uk. Conditions apply.
I'm telling you,
raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
Up to 9.13% annual return. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest property-backed from £500. Visit cufflink.com. That's K-U-F-L-I-N-K. Register your interest today. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to IF ISAs and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA.
James O'Brien on LBC.
11:48 is the time, and it is to the United States that we turn our attention next. And as ever, Simon Marks will be our Sherpa as we negotiate the mountainous territory of US politics. I suppose we should begin with the breaking news, or the very recent news, that the former Vice President Dick Cheney has passed away. A significant figure, Simon, in US politics, to say the least.
Absolutely, James. A figure whose political experience can be traced all the way back to Richard Nixon's White House, which is where he first worked. He had a job also under former President Gerald Ford, and then, of course, stood for Congress from Wyoming and rose through the ranks of the Republican Party, eventually to be pulled back into politics from a business career. Remember, he was the chief executive officer of Halliburton, one of the nation's largest businesses, supportive largely of the Republican Party, and he was brought back from that to become George W. Bush's vice president. We all used to think of Dick Cheney as being the Prince of Darkness of American politics. Indeed, he reveled in the fact that people used to compare him to Darth Vader. He didn't push back against those descriptions whatsoever, and he did indeed appear during his time as George W. Bush's vice president to be someone who was absolutely determined to push the boundaries of presidential power in the United States further than anyone had pushed them in the past. And certainly he was often portrayed as being the brains behind the George W. Bush political operation. I was never entirely sure that that was a completely fair assessment. But nonetheless, Dick Cheney dying at the age of 84 presents an issue for the current president of the United States, Donald Trump, who is pushing the powers of the presidency way beyond anything Dick Cheney even imagined. And the challenge is that, of course, there have been tremendous tensions between Donald Trump and the Cheney family. Yes. As a result of Dick Cheney's daughter, Liz Cheney, co-chairing the January the 6th committee up on Capitol Hill that looked into the insurrection, the deadly riots by Donald Trump supporters on January the 6th, 2021. And Dick Cheney's last appearance publicly in the US Congress was to walk into the building alongside his daughter Liz, an act of support for her, symbolizing his determination to back her as she tried to hold Donald Trump accountable for those January the 6th riots, an effort that ultimately we now know failed. But there is no love lost between Donald Trump and the Cheney family. And Dick Cheney, as a former vice president, I mean, one would imagine there will be conversations about whether he should lie in repose in the Capitol Rotunda. I mean, there were many Republicans, very few of them are the Donald Trump ilk, who really revered Dick Cheney as a political leader and the kind of tough guy. You know, he was one of the architects of the war on Iraq that America needed in the aftermath of 9/11. So complicated days after this announcement by the Cheney family that Dick Cheney is dead at the age of 84.
Yes, and I mean, you're right to remind us how far the Republican Party has moved away from what he represented, even when he was considered as an extremist within the sort of party fold, because Liz Cheney became not just a critic of Donald Trump, but a focal point for criticism of Donald Trump from within the Republican movement, a cohort that's more or less disappeared from public discourse now.
Absolutely. Liz Cheney has disappeared largely from public discourse. I think it's really important to underscore that Dick Cheney's death again reveals how far the Republican Party has shifted. Let me tell you something Dick Cheney never did. He never shut the American government down for 35 days. As of today, this is the longest government shutdown in history, the second longest government shutdown in history, the one orchestrated by Donald Trump back in 2018, which lasted 34 days. Mm. Something that Dick Cheney did do was at least support President George W. Bush as he made historic, unprecedented developmental and humanitarian assistance expenditures and interventions in Africa. That's not something that Donald Trump's done. He's completely eviscerated the U.S. Agency for International Development, something from which Dick Cheney would absolutely have recoiled. So this remaking of the United States that Donald Trump is leading, it takes the country down a path that is absolutely different to the path down which Dick Cheney, former CEO of Halliburton, the man who encouraged George W. Bush to go ahead with the invasion of Iraq, despite those critiques that are widespread of Dick Cheney's time as Vice President of the United States, he didn't come close to being a Make America Great Again Republican and absolutely eschewed the direction in which Donald Trump has taken this country.
We may have time to have a little look at some of the recent developments in that direction that Donald Trump has taken this country. But let's talk first about the election today. Or not just one election, there's a few elections, isn't there? The mayor race in New York City and then gubernatorial contests in Virginia and New Jersey. What's the significance?
Well, first of all, any time you get real voters casting actual votes, it does give you a pretty reliable barometer, at least of what people in those three locations, New York City, Virginia and New Jersey, are thinking. And the Democrats are obviously hoping to pull off wins in all three races today, plus also a ballot proposition out in California that would allow Gavin Newsom to redraw congressional boundaries and boost the number of seats that Democrats can count on in next year's midterm elections in response to Republican gerrymandering that has been taking place in other states. All eyes, of course, are on New York City. Zoran Mamdani, the Democrat socialist who is running for mayor of New York. He wants to make the buses free in New York. He wants to extend rent regulation on more than a million properties. He's talking about opening five city-owned supermarkets in a bid to try and bring food prices down. He is anathema to Donald Trump and to the captains of industry and commerce and finance in New York City, but he's also someone that many Democratic Party grandees are keeping at arm's length. Take a listen to what Hillary Clinton had to say the other day. She was asked who she's planning to vote for in the New York City mayoral race.
You know what? I don't vote in this city. I'm not involved in it. I have not, you know, been at all even asked to be involved in it, and I have not chosen to be involved in it.
She was talking there to the Unholy podcast, which explores issues pertaining to the Jewish community around the world and also to the relationship that various countries have with Israel. Zoran Mamdani, of course, is about to become the first Muslim Indian-American Democratic Socialist mayor of New York. So take a listen to what happened next on that Unholy podcast.
Do the Jews in the city have a reason to be concerned?
We'll have to see what happens. I hope not. I do not believe that we are able to predict what's going to happen. I can't sit here and tell you.
It's an extraordinary answer, that, because it really reveals the depth of anxiety that elites within the Democratic Party have about this firebrand young radical who is about to become the next mayor of New York City. He's going to win by a massive margin, we think, tonight. And he's really sending a message to the Democratic Party writ large that the party has to change. And people like Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, the New York senator who leads Democrats in the United States Senate, they've all kept him at arm's length because they are deeply concerned that that kind of populist left-wing radical is going to become a galvanizing figure for young grassroots Democrats and really challenge the elites within the party and tell them it's time for them to push off.
So I sort of we're seeing something similar here in a way, as if the established opposition has lost the room almost, and that the I choose my words carefully because we haven't seen him in action yet, and some of what he's said and done has been very impressive, but the perceived maverick hoovers up votes because people are sick of the status quo.
But there is a real challenge coming for the Democratic Party arising out of these elections, because if you go just south of us here in Washington, D.C. to Virginia, the Democrat who is expected to win that race for the gubernatorial mansion tonight is a centrist, Abigail Spanberger. And she has literally said, she's on a leaked audio tape, to prominent Democrats, that the party needs to stop even using the word socialist, that the word socialist is a complete switch off to the country. Mm. And if you carry on going out there and campaigning from the left and talking about being a socialist, you are going to lose the next election cycle. Well, she's going to become, we think, the next governor of Virginia tonight. So there's mixed messages coming from Democrats. On the one hand, in New York City, they're about to embrace someone of the left who describes himself as a democratic socialist. In Virginia, more conservative state to be sure, they are coalescing around a centrist figure who has said we shouldn't even be using these words, these buzz phrases that turn voters off. So the party is going to emerge from this off-year election, I think, in an even more confused state than it went into it, searching for leaders, but also still having to have an internal conversation with itself about what kind of path it wants to put itself on if it's ever going to combat Donald Trump's Make America Great Again populism.
Fascinating. I mean, genuinely fascinating, and all the more reason to speak to you soon about how things unfold. But of course, you could, or the United States could be at war with Nigeria by that point.
Absolutely astonishing. This announcement by President Trump on his social media channel over the weekend came seemingly out of nowhere, accusing the Nigerian government of standing by while Christians are being massacred in the country. We know that that message was fueled in part by Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who himself has focused extensively on what is taking place in Nigeria. But what is actually taking place in Nigeria certainly is seeing the murder of a large number of Christians in the country, but it's also seeing the murder of an even larger number of Muslims in Nigeria who are equally being targeted by Boko Haram and other Islamic fundamentalist terror groups. For them, not a solitary word was expressed by Donald Trump on Saturday as he threatened to send the U.S. military in to Nigeria to kill the Islamic fundamentalists that he claims are responsible for massacring Christians. And he put the Nigerian government on notice. The government, he said, better act fast, otherwise the military's coming. If you're a Make America Great Again supporter and you've backed the concept of Donald Trump being the peacemaker who's not going to get involved in far-off and distant conflicts about which we know very little, I mean, you'd think that Nigeria might tick those boxes, but on Saturday, he certainly was very focused on it.
Well, at least we can all agree he has. What's the running total now? He has ended 406 wars. Is that right?
and mounting.
And counting. Simon Marks, many thanks indeed. Live from Washington, D.C., where American politics, U.S. politics, shows no sign of calming down anytime soon. It's 12:01.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the Chancellor has repeatedly refused to rule out tax rises in the budget later this month. In a speech from Downing Street this morning, Rachel Reeves warned each of us must do our bit. She blamed years of Tory mismanagement and lower productivity rates for the hard choices that she'll have to make. But the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says Miss Rees' job will be untenable if she breaks Labour's manifesto promise on tax rises.
We were told that this was the great moment when Labour would show they had a plan for growth. Instead, what we got was a masterclass in managed decline. A Chancellor claiming she was just going to set the context, but instead of clarity, business leaders are none the wiser, investors are confused, workers are anxious, because the truth is, Labour doesn't have a plan to get Britain working again.
The FTSE 100 dropped more than 100 points following the Chancellor's speech a short time ago. The index was at 96.40. The pound also has fallen to $1.30 and €1.13. Rachel Rees will be speaking exclusively to Tonight with Andrew Marr here on LBC from 6 o'clock tonight. In other news this lunchtime, the former Republican US Vice President Dick Cheney has died at the age of 84. He served under George W. Bush for two terms between 2001 and 2009. His family has released a statement saying he died following complications of pneumonia. The family of a railway worker who tried to stop Saturday's mass stabbing on a train in Cambridgeshire say they're immensely proud of his courage. Samir Zittini remains in hospital. 32-year-old Anthony Williams has been charged with 10 counts of attempted murder. The far-right activist Tommy Robinson has been acquitted of a terror offence after refusing to give police his phone passcode. The request was made as part of an inspection at the Channel Tunnel last year. LBC's reporter Helen Hoddenott has more from Westminster's Magistrate Court.
Finding him not guilty today, the judge said the accounts of the three officers who struggled to recount why they arrested Mr. Lennon and the questions they asked him beyond his publicly known political beliefs were fundamentally unreliable. The judge said he cannot put it out of his mind that it was what Mr. Lennon stands for and his beliefs that were the reason for the stop. He explained that because that is a protected characteristic, it meant the stop was unlawful.
Sir Alan Bates has reportedly reached a seven-figure deal to settle his claim over the Post Office Horizon scandal. The former sub-postmaster has been leading the fight for justice for victims for more than 20 years. LBC weather, wet and windy for much of England and Wales this afternoon. Drier for northern Scotland and the south of England, but feeling very mild. A high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Five minutes after 12 is the time. It's a double whammy today of our favourite contributors, Simon Marks. A moment ago, Noga Tarnopolsky joining us live from Jerusalem at about 12:30 to talk us through a senior legal, the IDF's chief legal officer, has been arrested in Israel, accused of leaking a video of the apparent abuse of prisoners inside an Israeli facility, a hideous footage, but a truly almost impossible story to properly unravel. At least I think it would be for me. Happily, I can get Noga to do it in about 25 minutes' time. Sort of strange one next. I mean, it's something that we've talked about before, but not for a while. And it's always slightly gratifying to notice that you're mind is still capable of changing. At what age do people become stuck? Some people seem to get stuck at 15. You look at someone like Jacob Rees-Mogg. I don't think he's got an opinion today that he didn't have when he was 12. Do you? And is that a strength? When the facts change, sir, I change my mind. What do you do? I don't change my mind. Some people don't have any opinions at all. They seem to blow in the wind as if it was, as if they were kites. Untethered kites just blowing on whatever direction the wind may take them. But surely the best people are the people who have opinions, have views that they've thought about carefully, and then when something changes, they think about them again, and their view can actually change. I'll tell you what I've been reading again, and I should be careful. It's an incredible essay, which was published in Harper's Magazine, I think between the wars. Well, it must have been between the wars. By a woman, a historian and writer, who went on to be a tireless chronicler of Nazism. She's called Dorothy Thompson. And she wrote, we're not talking about this, by the way. We're going to be talking about smartphones in schools, but I'm going off on one of my tangents. If this was an Alan Bennett play, someone would say, he's going off on one of his tangents. He's going off on one of his tangents. She wrote an essay called Who Goes Nazi for Harper's Bazaar. And she's sitting in a room and working her way through it, going around the room, explaining why that person would go Nazi and that person would not. It is one of the most haunting pieces that I've ever read, because it's only relatively recently that I've heard the hoots of haunting in my consciousness. I never really, when I first read it and acknowledged its absolute brilliance, I never really thought it would be relevant to my life or my era. But looking at how some British political figures have responded to the increasing fascistic nature of Donald Trump's regime, you find yourself wondering, well, who? I'm just in journalism. Post January the 6th, the lies and the violence, deal breaker for everybody decent. And you suddenly realize, no, not a deal breaker for him, not a deal breaker for her. Who goes Nazi? It speaks about some characters who you can almost recognize from public discourse in this country, people who've lurched so far to the right they're in danger of falling off the table because they are frustrated by the refusal of the academic world to properly recognize their brilliance or reward them. It is an absolutely brilliant article, one of the finest pieces I've ever read, because it's crept up on me in the last couple of years. I've mentioned it to you before. It's crept up on me in the last couple of years because I kept hearing echoes of it. And I went back to it over the weekend and read it again. And yes, I was hearing echoes of it. And some of it was absolutely, I'd be flirting with libel, I suppose, to actually name names. Even in an era where very prominent people can do Nazi salutes in public and it doesn't become a deal breaker. But have a read of it and see if you recognize any types, any tropes from the current political arena. Who Goes Nazi by Dorothy Thompson. If you only take one recommendation from me on things to read, then I would be perfectly happy for that to be the only one. 10 minutes after 12 is the time. So, smartphones. Two stories that I think are really interesting. One is about an Australian family who have moved here because the Australian government is getting serious. A family of Australian influencers have moved to the UK because the government is banning social media for all under 16s. And what I like about this story is the fact that it highlights, albeit that it's only one family, it highlights, I think, the seriousness of this policy. So when we first heard about it, and this may be, of course, the first you have heard about it, we kind of thought, or I kind of thought, well, it can't be quite what it says on the tin. They can't be banning access to all social media for everybody under 16 in the entire country. That just sounds like an impossible aim. It sounds like an unfeasible mission. It can't be that. We must have misunderstood it. We must be getting slightly bolderized reporting. It must be Chinese whispers. By the time, I know it's unlikely in the world of technology that we inhabit that a story could actually change in tone and content on a journey through the ether from Australia to the United Kingdom. But it feels so huge. A decision for a government to take in an English-speaking, you know, in a country that is a lot like ours, but with better weather. The idea that the government could literally say to every under-16-year-old in the land, sorry, social media is no longer for you. But what this story about this family, the Lee family, L-E-A, have got a 17-year-old son and a 14-year-old daughter, and the 14-year-old daughter is popular online. She has a million followers online, and because she would be banned from Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat, X, and YouTube, will be banned from December the 10th, they've emigrated to the United Kingdom so that she can keep her... I mean, the whole family are influencers, so it's not just her. I think it's their income. They make their money by uploading content, as a lot of people do, an increasing number of people do, and they have now relocated to the United Kingdom as a direct consequence of Australia bringing in a complete ban on smartphones. Not on smartphones, on social media, all social media. The other story is about 250 head teachers and chief executives of trusts calling for a statutory ban on smartphones in schools. And do you know, as I've set up these two connected stories, I've suddenly realised there's two phone-ins here, not one, isn't there? There's one about phones in schools, and there's another one about banning social media entirely. So do we save one until tomorrow, or do we try and do them both now, given that we've got Noga joining us at 12:30? So we're only going to have about 40 minutes of conversation, and I'm probably going to talk for another 10, because that's what I do. What do you think? Should we do one now and one tomorrow? I want to do the social media one first, and we maybe have a look at the schools one tomorrow. You can tell we're live, can't you? You don't get this. You don't get this on pre-recorded programs. Let's do this one now. So, Australia, just pay attention. This is really huge. Australia, the Australian government, is banning everybody under 16 from the entirety of social media. Wow. I mean, like, wow. What is going to happen? Do we know? I mean, I don't... Is it going to work? Have they gone mad? Is it brilliant or is it bonkers? I genuinely think it's... Well, I don't know. It does have some positive purposes, social media. At least I think it does. This is an enormous moment, isn't it? You look back in years to come on this moment or on this era of social media dominating the lives of so many young people, for good or for ill, and realise it was optional all along. Has Australia gone completely bonkers, or is this a brilliant move that we should emulate as soon as possible? Hit the numbers now, you will get through. I want you to think about your own teenage years. I want you to think about your own teenagers. I just want to reflect upon, in a way, two elements of this story. The ban is coming on December the 10th, which is soon, but a family of influencers has moved here so that their 14-year-old daughter can maintain her fashion and makeup online presence, which enjoys 1 million followers. And the scale of the ambition here seems to me to be immense. Sometimes I think it's almost like a sort of form of excess caution. If somebody says they're going to do something which feels absolutely huge, it knocks at the door of impossible. It's as if you're trying to get, I'm going to use my all-time favourite analogy now, which was coined during Brexit, it's as if they're trying to get the eggs out of a baked cake. It's as if the reach, the influence of social media into teenage lives is so complete and so comprehensive that trying to suck the tentacles out again, trying to somehow just guillotine it off, ban it completely. You're 15, you're not allowed on Facebook, you're not allowed on TikTok, you're not allowed on Instagram, you're not allowed on Snapchat, you're not allowed on YouTube, you're not allowed on Twitter. So, but Dad, I spend 7 hours a day on those platforms. I don't care. It's over. It's finished. It's done with. Do we even know the answer to the question of what that's going to do? Working on the presumption that it works, that it's feasible, that it's delivered, what will it do? What do you think it will do? What difference will it make to the lives of these young people and the entire society? 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. What? Just one thing. You don't need to give me a chapter and verse. Just the big thing. The big change. As of December the 10th, you're not allowed on social media if you're under 16 and you're in Australia. What would change? For better or for worse, give me the big ones. Give me the biggies, OK? 0345-6060-973. And then I suppose a little bit of Will It Work. A little bit of wow. Seriously. That's the last time you heard something like this. It's like trying to uninvent the wheel. Or ban 16-year-olds, ban 15-year-olds from using wheels. I feel that social media is so utterly inserted into our lives, so of a piece with our existences. For a lot of people, don't at me to tell me you don't use it. That's a completely unnecessary contribution to the programme. It really is. I don't want to sound rude, but honestly, jog on. What on earth will this do? We don't even know. I can't have a phone in about what the future's going to look like or what the current present is going to look like in the future. But what if we sit here 10 years from now and go, oh my days, we used to let children do this. We used to let children on social media. Spoiled the brains of their parents. Why the hell are we letting them anywhere near it? So just give me your straight response to this story, because I'm blessed with children, full stop, actually. But I one element of my blessing is that neither of my children, and I don't know that we did anything right, Mrs. O'Brien probably exerted influence, but neither of my children have ever really been in thrall to social media. We've been very, very lucky. But they go on stuff, they enjoy things, they like YouTube. I mean, YouTube in particular seems like quite a brutal denial for children. It may not be an unalloyed good thing, but that's the kind of contribution I want you to make. I want you to tell me. This is happening in Australia on December the 10th, okay? So it is happening in Australia literally a month and a week from today. Everybody under 16 will be overnight banned from using all of these online platforms. The government has said that the young Australians would be protected at a critical... Protected at a critical stage of their development, giving them 3 more years to build real-world connections and online resilience. What do you think of that? 0345-6060-973.
This is LBC.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe, only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 991234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
New In, the latest custom-fit rechargeable hearing devices. Discreet, comfortable, and smart enough to help you catch every moment. Book a free hearing test at bootshearingcare.com. T's and C's apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345-6060-973.
21 minutes after 12. Should we just rattle through all the comedians before we crack on with the actual subject matter? So Will says, when are you going to do the Australian accent, James? He sent that after I did it. James says, are all Australians from Dudley? Vic in Barking says, fabulous Irish accent, James. And Mick says, did I just hear that accent right, James? They're banning social media in Wales. Yeah, hilarious, hilarious, hilarious. Well done, everybody. Ha, 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 ha. No, they're banning social media in Australia. And it's extraordinary. I genuinely can't get my head around it. I saw the story ages ago, and a little bit of me just doused it down. Anyway, I'll shut up and take your calls. Wendy's in Llanelli. Wendy, what would you like to say?
I'm all for the ban, and I think it should be a global thing, because there are so many channels on YouTube that have pregnancy, birthing videos, children in their swimming costumes, children in the bathtub, doing gymnastics and things like that, where the children are exploited and the parents make a huge amount of money. You just look at a child on in the thumbnails, you'll see the views are incredible. Now, there is a channel on YouTube called the Dad Challenge Podcast.
Yeah, but this isn't about that, is it? This is a ban on them using it.
Yeah, but if they're not online and they're not allowed to use it, then one, they're not going
to
get.
But there's nothing to stop their parents making films with them in it for their followers.
So far.
No, you can't do that. You can't ban people from filming their own children playing football.
There are, I believe, some the states in America that have started this.
Really?
That trying to ban children online, yeah. As I say, Dad Challenge Podcast started in June 2020, and he started looking into the exploitation of children, and not just the exploitation of children, but children seeing inappropriate content.
I don't want to sound ungrateful, Wendy, but that's not quite the phone-in that we're having today. It's about banning children from using YouTube, which they might use to watch their favourite comedian or reruns of their favourite television show, banning them from using Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, Snapchat, X. I appreciate there's a lot of dodgy stuff on the internet, and some of it no doubt involves exploitation of children by their own parents, but that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about banning it so completely, and we're wondering about A, the plausibility of that ban, and B, the probable impact of it. What do you think it would change to just overnight tell someone who is, say, 15 and a half and spends a good 3 or 4 hours a day after school on their favourite platforms every night, to no apparent detriment, that's it, game over, we're pulling the plug?
But they've also found things on, like, YouTube Kids where there's been hidden messages about suicide.
Okay. No, I hear you, and those are definitely concerns, but as I did try quite hard to stress, they're not the concerns that we're talking about today. Tony's in Clapham. Tony, what do you reckon?
Hiya, James. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
Good. I'm very well. Thanks.
Carry on. Fill your boots, Tony.
So I just wanted to say, I think social media on a whole is a very adult thing when you think about it. You find content that you like. It can be a range of anything.
Can I intervene at this point?
Of course you can.
You don't have any children.
Who, me?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
No, I know. Because they're on it all the time. It's not a very adult thing at all. It's absolutely popular with and attuned for young people. I mean, the algorithm gives you what you like.
I do not disagree.
You might even like Bluey Phil on YouTube.
I do not disagree. I do not disagree that there is a range of content on there. I'm talking about the effect it has on the mind.
Mm.
So social media has been gamified to increase engagement. So that means there are addictive features within social media, which are put in there to make you look at the screen, like, comment, share. You know, these are.
Yeah, I like that. I think we should have used the word addiction sooner, actually, because that it underpins the unhealthy and you know, lots of things that are addictive you're allowed to access, but there aren't many addictive things that you're allowed to access when you're 15.
Well, when you're 15, you can't go to
or 12.
You can't gamble, can you?
No, and you can't drink. And in fact, in Australia, it's really hard to get hold of.
We know that roulette machines, for example,
yes,
they have addictive features in them, don't they?
Hell yes.
Yeah, yeah. The same features are being used in social media.
So what happens overnight?
I don't think it is overnight.
No, it is overnight. They're banning it on December the 10th. Why has everybody been so obtuse this hour? What happens on December the 11th?
Well, the kids won't have access.
And what are they going to do?
They're going to read books,
yeah,
go outside, play with their friends, do more positive things that allow them to
whittle
to
sticks.
Explore who they are.
They're going to whittle sticks, I think, and go fishing.
Hey, it didn't do me any bad.
I'll be the judge of that. Thank you. I mean, it feels like a great idea. And I don't want to be that guy who lets the quibblings cut, oh, everyone's going to get a VPN, everyone's going to do this, everyone's going to do that. But it's so immense. Like, what was it? We haven't actually banned smoking. It felt huge when they banned it in certain, you know, indoors, in pubs and things like that. But it's nothing like this. It's like literally saying, loads of people are doing that now. Tomorrow they won't be allowed to. Can you think of anything that fits into that category? Like a complete prohibition, albeit only for people under 16. Toby's in Nottingham. Toby, what made you pick up the phone?
I guess I was probably one of the younger people out there that kind of relied on social media a lot when I was younger. So
yes, in a good way.
In a good way, I would say so, for the most part, yeah.
Yeah.
13, 14, 15, most of my life outside of school was lived online. And I think there's a lot of young people out there who are probably going to be affected negatively, but on the whole, I do, now I'm this age and, you know, got this different worldview, I think that it's probably a good thing on the whole.
Oh, okay. So you were quite lonely?
To a degree.
Offline?
I mean, a lot of my interactions with my friends from school were also,
sorry, I misunderstood you slightly.
But I mean, it's kind of a bit of both, because I've got friends, lifelong friends now that I still speak to that I met online when I was that age, and they were the same age as me. So I really don't know how far this goes in terms of positives. Obviously, there's the lack of risk and things like that you're going to remove from young people's lives, but there's also that negative side of people who maybe do rely on it.
And they're going to be caught up in it, aren't they? Most obviously, I suppose, people who are housebound or agoraphobic, or in Australia, if you're stuck in the middle of nowhere, if your dad runs a sheep farm or something like that. Sorry to indulge in stereotypes, but you know, they have flying doctors for a reason. So why are you broadly warm towards it then, given that it was essentially a benign influence on you?
I think it's just because I'm highly aware of the risk, especially nowadays with, you know, serial predators online who will seek out people who aren't that age and vulnerable. Even as young as, you know, 10, 11, or maybe even younger than that, the children just are given access to, you know, devices and different forms of media where they're not going to have that, you know, wherewithal in order to deal with people that might be nefarious and parents that might not, you know, be looking over their shoulder while they're online.
And oddly, it is one of those rare subjects that fits perfectly into the parameters of in my day-itis, because if you want to have an idea of what life was like before social media, then hello from 1972 life was perfectly pleasant, arguably more pleasant, because albeit that there were stresses and difficulties involved in being young, and there always will be, the sense that they're magnified and exacerbated in general, if not for everybody, by social media is pretty hard to resist. So you've got the potential of abuse. You've got the commercial exploitation, the addictive nature of it. You've got the loss of other skills, be it social skills or even motor skills in some case, and physicality. What is not to like? Answer, some people, a relatively small number of people, rely upon it for whatever social life they've got, which is when in my day-itis kicks in and say, well, we had people living in those sort of circumstances before social media and they all seem okay. It's a weird one.
I guess another thing that I've just thought of is what happens to the young people below the age of 16 that rely on social media for things that their parents might not be talking to them about, like things that are risky within their community or things that even their parents might not be aware of that these young people aren't catching on to because they're being fed on social media.
Well, that feels like a step back rather than a step forward, which is why we're having this conversation, because it's not an immediate slam dunk of a story. The more you think about it, at first glance, it is a bit of a slam dunk. It's either this is an absolutely brilliant idea or it's an absolutely awful idea. In fact, it'll be both. So the utilitarian question becomes, like, is there enough brilliance to it to cancel out the awfulness and make it, in a utilitarian sense, the best thing for a society to do for the greater good? Whew. Noga Tarnopolsky joining us live from Jerusalem after the very latest headlines with Tim Humphrey.
The Tories claim the Chancellor's job will be untenable if she breaks Labour's manifesto pledges on tax rises. Rachel Reeves is refusing to rule out any increases in this month's budget, saying she'll do what's necessary to protect families and bring down government debt. Dick Cheney, the former Vice President of the United States, has died at the age of 84. He was a leading advocate of the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Tommy Robinson's been cleared of a terror offence after refusing to give police his phone PIN number. The former leader of the English Defence League was stopped at the Channel Tunnel in Folkestone with thousands of pounds in cash. LBC weather, further heavy rain in Wales and northern and western England, brighter but with showers elsewhere, and a high of 16 degrees.
This is LBC.
The new single drops. The world tour begins. As artists create the music we love, you could be right there in the mix. Calling all young creatives. If you want a career in music, then listen up. Global Academy have a new 6-4 music production course. State-of-the-art studios, practical experience, hands-on learning with music professionals. Awesome. Apply now at globalacademy.com.
I'm telling you, raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
Up to 9.13% annual return. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest property-backed from £500. Visit cufflink.com. That's K-U-F-L-I-N-K. Register your interest today. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to IF ISAs and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA.
At TfL, we're helping make roads safer. We're continuing to roll out lower speed limits because 20 miles per hour roads have already seen 24% fewer collisions causing death or serious injury. We're also improving junctions to help keep you safe and improving visibility for our bus drivers with new wing mirror cameras. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Comparison of collisions data before and after implementation of 20 miles per hour speed limit.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters. On your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 12:34 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where we will return imminently to the conversation. That's a good line about it being a social experiment with a very, very vulnerable test group. I hadn't thought of it like that. Australia's imminent blanket ban on social media access for under 16s. But it is to Israel, or back to Israel, that we go next, happily in the company of the freelance reporter Noga Tarnopolsky, who is based in Jerusalem. And it is, it's a remarkable story, Noga, that I need you to talk us through, because the chief legal officer of the IDF is, under arrest for leaking that video that caused a lot of jaws to drop earlier this year, depicting apparent abuse of prisoners in an Israeli jail. What's going on exactly?
That's right, James. It's really an astonishing story, and I have to tell you that I think we still know very little of what's really going on. But your audience will remember what is still being called Israel's Abu Ghraib, a video that came out from an Israeli military base, in fact, called Sde Teiman, where reserve soldiers were charged with watching over Gazans, Palestinians who had been taken prisoner or detained. And there was video, obviously taken by a soldier, another soldier who was disturbed by what he was seeing, that showed catastrophic torture and abuse of at least one detainee, including very violent sexual abuse. And this came out about a year ago, and in Israel there was an increasing drumbeat on the one side from, let's call it, the law, rule of law side of society, saying, how come no one's been charged? What's happening? And on the other side, the government side, it began to be called a blood libel, as if that video were a lie being perpetrated against pure soldiers. Mm. And what's happened in the last few days is that as a result of her spokesperson undergoing a pretty random polygraph test, the judge advocate general, the chief legal officer of the IDF, admitted that she is the one who received that video legally and then leaked it to the media. It's not clear that that is illegal. But what is remarkable, you know, there are leaks all the time. What is amazing is she has been jailed and accused of a series of crimes, the lightest of which is breach of the public trust. And there are calls within the government that her arrest is being perceived by the Israeli government as a reason to cancel the charges, all of the charges against the soldiers who, again, were videotaped perpetrating this terrible act of abuse.
One of the victims was admitted to hospital with severe rib and rectal injuries. Which
That's right. That's who I was speaking about.
I realize that. I think perhaps you maybe overestimate how aware many of my listeners will be of the original story. Because, well, just because it obviously doesn't get the level of coverage here that it gets in Israel. But this then turns into grounds for not pursuing investigation. I mean, that doesn't make any obvious legal sense.
It gets worse.
Go on.
It turns out that this man, who underwent months and months of medical treatment in Israeli hospitals, was quietly released back to Gaza last month in the middle of October, when in Israel all eyes were on the release of the still-living hostages. And that is very significant because, again, this could very well be part of a cover-up, since the principal witness to his own torture and abuse has been released. And, you know, there's no clear access to him now. The only way to get first-person testimony now would be to have soldiers testifying against other soldiers.
So they're hoping to have cauterized the whole episode then?
Well, I think they're trying to pretend it never happened.
Yeah.
And I have to add another thing.
Of course.
This is happening in a very particular moment in Israeli history in which the prime minister, who is on trial, who was forced to show up in court today again despite trying to get it cancelled again, he is trying to get his own trial cancelled. So what's happening relating to the judge advocate general and her team and her jailing and the accusations against her now, you know, the Israeli social media is awash with calls to hang her and more violent things. And what we're seeing is kind of, you know, the fist of an attempt to take over the state. I say this sometimes when I speak with you on the radio, but right now it really is rule of law versus takeover of state. That's the place Israel is at. So it may be less shocking to Israelis right now to contemplate, well, maybe these guys shouldn't be on trial at all. Maybe it was all a lie. Maybe it was an AI video and so forth, because their own prime minister is trying to get off his trial. He asked President Donald Trump to request a pardon for him. It's illegal in Israel. No foreign leader can manipulate the Israeli judiciary that way. The justice minister has illegally appointed someone of a crony of the government to try to examine what took place in that military base where the soldiers were accused of abuse. So we really are in the clutch of a wide-ranging attempt to take over the levers of power in the state. And the story of this general, Yifat Tomer Yerushalmi, one of the few female generals in IDF, is an example.
How does it break down, do you think? I know this is a very difficult question to answer, but and possibly impossible. But you mentioned some of the hideousness on social media. If it's possible in percentage terms, how do the advocates of the rule of law break down against those who would be comfortable with its abandonment, do you think, in numbers, in percentage terms?
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly, it's hard for me to answer.
I know it is.
But I'll tell you this. Yeah. What I can say to you is, I think that it's a substantial minority. Who would prefer. Well, but the problem is they're the ones in power.
Yes, exactly.
Remember, the Minister for National Security of Israel is a guy who is a street thug, who 30 years ago this week threatened the life of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin just before he was assassinated, who attacked his vehicle, who has a long career, 13 convictions for hate crimes. This is who Netanyahu appointed to lead Israel's internal security. Again, it all goes back to his trial, because he needed to put together a coalition that would protect him. And this is what Israel's gotten.
Finally, Noga, and I know you've answered this, but just to clarify it further, when Netanyahu calls the fallout from this video perhaps the most severe propaganda attack against the state of Israel in its history, what exactly is he talking about? What is he claiming there?
I'm so glad you've asked me this. I'm so happy you've asked me this. Listen, what he said makes no sense even in Hebrew.
Right.
And then it's got mistranslated into English.
Yes.
But, you know, this is very Netanyahu. He sat in his cabinet meeting just yesterday, and he said, what he said is, as if PR could be an act of terror. He said, this is the most severe act of PR terror perpetrated against the state since its establishment. What is he referring to? He was referring to the fact that the video of soldiers torturing Palestinians became public. Now, this is part of the Prime Minister's efforts to erase his own culpability. The fact that one of the worst terror attacks in history anywhere, a terror attack in which 1,200 Israelis were massacred, happened under his watch. Mm. He hasn't taken any responsibility for that. Instead, he's going around blaming everyone else for everyone and calling any insult to himself, which he considered this, an act of terror. So again, Israel really is in the clutches of a very, very complicated effort to take over power, and this is part of it.
And it goes hand in hand with the claim that any accusations levelled against the guards, the apparent footage notwithstanding, constitute a, quote, blood libel, end quotes, which is, I mean, you can say that.
No, I apologise. Go ahead.
No, I would hesitate to accuse him of diluting the potency of the accusation of a blood libel, but it's hard to see how it fits the traditional terms of that phrase in the context that we're discussing.
It's a term that goes back to Shakespeare.
Yes, of course.
Right? And The Merchant of Venice. And it's a horrific, because, you know, just this week, Rabbi Delphine Auvieux of Paris was in Israel, and she gave an interview, and she spoke about how there's a reality outside Israel which Israelis know little about and their prime minister doesn't want them to know about, in which Jews around the world are really suffering an unprecedented wave of anti-Semitism since, let's say, in the last half century, and are genuinely afraid. And we saw, of course, what happened in Manchester in the UK. And so when the prime minister accuses his own chief judicial officer of the army of perpetrating a blood libel, he's equating her with the filthiest anti-Semites of medieval Europe. And he's turning her into an enemy of the state. And this is one of the reasons for the breakdown of law and order, the total confusion about what's up and what's down right now in the state of Israel.
Noga, last time we spoke, everyone was moved by your happiness and euphoria as we discussed the release of hostages. I sense that normal service has been resumed now, almost.
Well, I would say so. Plus, you know, the realization that the release of these hostages, almost all of whom are Israelis, but there were some foreigners, there are still two foreigners among the dead who are still being held by Hamas, had nothing to do with the government of the State of Israel. The government of the State of Israel has forsaken its actual job, which is protecting the security of state and protecting the security of citizens. And so a character such as Donald Trump, who sees an opportunity to be viewed as a hero and as a peacemaker, is able to step into the vacuum here. And the realization, including for themselves and for their families, that the few remaining living hostages got out thanks to the intervention of, let's say, you know, like a foreign pasha, a foreign strongman.
Yeah.
It's very sobering, as you hear in my voice now, yeah, in terms of the rule of law in Israel.
Brilliantly put. Bleak, but brilliantly put, Noga. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And I always come away knowing a heck of a lot more than I did before the conversation began. Thank you. Noga Tarnopolsky speaking to us live from Jerusalem, where, as you hear, the detention of the IDF's top lawyer poses all sorts of broader questions about the role of rule of law in that country. It is 12:47.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
If we are to build the future, each of us must do our bit.
Rachel Reeves inches towards raising income tax and wants you to understand why she might. And how visible is knife crime where you live?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or our new LBC app.
I like my private details on a need-to-know basis. In other words, I need to know them and you don't. That's why I use Bitdefender whenever I'm connected, working tirelessly in the background to protect me across all my devices, keeping my digital identity confidential, on the down low, on the hush-hush, trusted by the experts, used by the pros.
Bitdefender, a global leader in cybersecurity. Trusted, always.
Verify now at bitdefender.com.
Do you ever feel like getting back under your duvet in the middle of the day? Ferroglobin is a great-tasting liquid formula with iron, which contributes to the reduction of tiredness and fatigue and normal formation of hemoglobin. Ferroglobin, from Vitabiotics. At Boots, pharmacies and vitabiotics.com.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Oh, recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helps advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
Calling all black cab drivers. Let's talk about those quieter times when your meter's sitting idle and those journeys when you're coming back empty. Why not consider Uber? They can give your meter a boost just when you need it. Join close to 1,000 black cab drivers already on Uber and gain access to millions of passengers at the touch of a button. Black cabs on Uber are priced by your meter, and the service fee will be no more than 5% until the end of 2025. Turn downtime into prime time. Go to uber.com/blackcabs to start earning today. Terms and conditions apply.
We had our smart meter installed a year ago, and it's made things so much easier. Not having to submit meter readings or having to deal with estimated bills is great.
A smart meter sends meter readings direct to your energy supplier. It means you get accurate bills, not estimated bills, and you don't even need an internet connection. Call your energy supplier to request a smart meter today.
Real testimonials voiced by actors. Eligibility may vary.
Leading Britain's conversation. LBC with James O'Brien.
It's 10 minutes to 1. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. And we return to the vexed question of the Australian government essentially banning all social media for under-16s, age-restricted social media platforms. So they will, a bit like what they've done with porn in this country, you won't be able to get on unless you can prove your age, prove that you're over 16. And, of course, as with pornography in this country, some people will be able to bypass it. But what will be the point unless everybody does it? You know, if it's a relatively small number of under-16s who, without their parents' knowledge, have managed to set up a fake account, then you're not going to be doing the socialising with your own peer group that is part of the aim of the legislation. A lot of admiration coming in for Noga, who always does such an extraordinary job of providing us with clear-eyed analysis of incredibly difficult situations. 12:51 is the time. Sarah is in Southend. Sarah, what would you like to say?
Yeah, that's quite hard to come back after that topic, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So I understand why governments are reaching for these ways of making sure that we're protected, whether it's because of our age, whatever. But if you remember, when the social media platforms first came on stream, if you like, the publishing industry said that they should be regulated as though they were publishers, just digital publishers. And I think that maybe governments need to revisit that argument again, because if you imagine what Meta and YouTube and all the rest of them would be like if they had to follow the same rules as publishers for, you know, whichever country you're operating in, I think it would take away a lot of the reasons that we don't want our children to go on social media and engage with it.
So you'd go for moderation rather than prohibition? By moderation, I mean moderating, but compulsory regulating of content.
Yeah, you know, I mean, publishers, you know, magazines. So, you know, it used to be magazines, wasn't it, that you saw your porn, and there were limits. You know, there was
speak for yourself, Sarah.
I understand that was the way. That's what we always say, isn't it? I'm of that age group where I was an adult, but when these things came online, social media,
my
husband used to work in publishing, and it was massive at the time because they all said, "How can we ever compete if the same rules don't apply to these new publishers that are just publishing online digitally?" And I think there was a point where social media and social media platforms were great and they were useful. And also the other concern I have is if you say to young people, you can't use it at all, it's a blanket ban, how are they ever going to get the resilience or the knowledge to cope with it when they are?
I just thought of that, actually, after talking to Noga, when that idea that you will just be thrown into the pool at 16. But didn't that happen to all of us?
I mean, look what it's done to older people. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I think we all need protecting from some of the stuff that has been allowed to be put up online when they know damn well they wouldn't be able to get away with it in any other sort of sphere of production.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. So, I mean, there's so many different dimensions to this conversation, as you know, every caller has reminded us. But the idea of harmful content as opposed to, you know, perfectly legal bullying or teasing or unpleasantness, but actively harmful content or misinformation or lies is going to be affecting adults, if not as much, then more than it is children. I don't know if you heard, Kate's call yesterday describing her husband and the glee that she could see on his face when he thought that the terrible events on the train on Saturday night was an act of terrorism. The glee he felt when it was going to be, proof that asylum seekers are all awful. And I said to her, where does he get, does he spend a lot of time online? Straight away, all his time. He spends all his time online. The damage that's been done to him, you know, a middle-aged man, goodness knows what damage it can do to young people, but the responsibility for removing the damaging content has been completely swerved by these platforms. Owned, of course, by the men who were sitting behind Donald Trump at his inauguration while his cabinet were in the row behind them. So, you know, whether you're owning the Washington Post or Facebook or Twitter, that's it. You are the earls and the dukes in the court of King Don, and you can do whatever you want, which was kind of the plan, wasn't it? Sarah, thank you. Ellis is in Preston. Ellis, what would you like to say?
Hi there.
Hello,
Ellis. Hi. I would say, I think there's a balance to everything. Doing it overnight would be an absolute shock to the system.
Yes. But you can't wean them off it. You can't say, right, you can just do it like the 3 hours today, 2 hours tomorrow, and 1 hour on Monday.
Yeah, no, that wouldn't work. I mean, myself, I'm 27, and I took a year out of social media. But I think there's obviously a big age difference being a teenager and slightly older to just cutting it out, because you can see what it's doing to yourself.
Mm.
I have, like, younger people in my family, and I can see that individuality is completely gone. Personality is gone. Really? In a sense of, yeah, just like they're ticking boxes to make sure they fit in, or even designing bedrooms. It's come down to a certain aesthetic that they see on social media.
Okay.
And then having to post that, maybe getting validation that it's correct.
Yeah, I mean, that's not, I mean, it's annoying and it's sad, but it's not harmful. Is it? Or is it, I mean, in the purest sense of the word.
I don't think it's harmful, but I think it would be good to know yourself and your mind, although it's all part of growing up, as long as you don't let it take over. And I think
I used to dress like Morton Harkett when I was their age, out of a har. I must have looked absolutely ridiculous, but I was trying to fit a sort of externally imposed template when social media was just it was sort of confined to the realms of Star Trek. Probably. So I don't know that we can blame social media for young people being impressionable.
No. I think, like I said, everything has a balance.
Yes, that's true. So you find the idea of 100% ban a little bit very difficult to countenance.
Yeah. And I think there might be a way around it.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a reason not to do it. There's a way around everything. People drink drive despite pretty hectic, hefty drink driving legislation. I can't wait to see what happens, actually. We should probably get somebody on that for us. But what is going to happen when you wake up in Australia in the second week in December and nobody under 16 can get onto any social media platforms at all? Which means they'll lose a ton of money, potentially, because if the numbers fall measurably, then the advertising revenues fall commensurately. And that, of course, is what it's always all about. Not just controlling hearts and minds and allowing influence to be peddled, regardless of whether it's based on facts or lies, but also to make a ton of money while you're doing it. And, of course, the eagle-eyed among you will have noticed on the YouTube broadcast of this program, which goes live in the early afternoon, mid-afternoon usually, that I still pursue my little Morton Harkett tribute with a charming array of bracelets.
How did he dress? I can't remember.
He used to wear leather thongs all the way up his right arm, and I think his left arm as well. Beautiful man.
And that was it?
Well,
what else did he do?
Waistcoats. He had a nice bouffant haircut.
Is he? Aha.
Aha. Aha. Aha. If you miss any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app, or indeed the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date on all the top stories and opinions. Put your news categories in the order you want, as well as Pause and Rewind live radio. There's also a range of podcasts there, including mine, James O'Brien Daily, the best bits from this show every day, and Full Disclosure, a long-form interview project, which this week features Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Tom Swarbrick will be with you at 4, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Uh-huh, thank you. 3 today. Samir Zitouni, remember his name. He's the rail guard who risked his life and saved many other lives during Saturday's train knife attack. We wish him well. A man has been charged with the incident and others. Just how visible and flagrant is knife wielding where you live? But I'm going to start with that unexpected breakfast meeting with the Chancellor.
It looks like she's going to raise income tax.
It certainly does look like she's going to raise income tax. She didn't say she was, but it did see her go back to David Cameron, George Osborne's austerity, to Brexit, and to Tory mismanagement of the economy. All true. She's going to put things right, she says. With our help, she says. Will she? And will you help?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the Chancellor's given her biggest signal yet that she might raise taxes in her budget at the end of the month. At a Downing Street news conference, Rachel Reeves said she would take hard choices to protect families from high inflation and bring down government debt.
If we are to build the future of Britain together, we will all have to contribute to that effort. Each of us must do our bit for the security of our country and the brightness of its future.
The Conservatives say the Chancellor's job will be untenable if she breaks an election pledge not to raise income tax. Rachel Reeves will be speaking exclusively to Tonight with Andrew Marr here on LBC from 6 o'clock this evening. Right-wing activist Tommy Robinson has been cleared of a terror offence after refusing to give police his phone passcode. He was stopped at the Channel Tunnel last year. Dick Cheney, who served as US Vice President under George W. Bush, has died at the age of 84. He was best known as an advocate for the invasion of Iraq. And LBC's Washington correspondent Simon Marks says he was a huge influence behind the scenes.
We all used to think of Dick Cheney as being the Prince of Darkness of American politics. Indeed, he reveled in the fact that people used to compare him to Darth Vader. He didn't push back against those descriptions whatsoever.
Sir Alan Bates has settled his claim for compensation over the post office IT scandal. It's understood the former sub-postmaster who led the campaign for justice will receive a seven-figure sum from the government. Lord Arbuthnot, who took the Horizon campaign to Parliament, says it's an important milestone.
It's great that Sir Alan Bates, who is the hero of this story, should finally have settled his claim. But let's not forget there are lots of others who are still fighting.
The family of the rail worker who was injured trying to protect passengers during Saturday's stabbings on a train to London say he's always been their hero. Operator LNER says Thami Zituni did not hesitate to step forward. The owner of Primark is considering splitting the retailer from its food business. AB Foods annual profits fell 13% to £1.7 billion. It owns Kingsmill, Twinings and Rivita. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 50 points at 96.51. The pound buys $1.31 and €1.14. LBC weather, further heavy rain in Wales and northern and western England, brighter but with showers elsewhere, and a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Tim Humphrey.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello, good afternoon. It's not often I find myself rapidly taking notes at 8 o'clock in the morning or just after 8 o'clock in the morning when a Chancellor is giving a speech followed by a Q&A with journalists. But we did this morning, Rachel Reeves, in her own words, saying she felt it was the courteous thing to do to set out exactly what she's facing as she makes decisions about the budget. So she's setting out what the problems are while she works out how she's going to respond to those problems. That was essentially the sort of heart of the press conference today. It does look as though she's, what do they call it, rolling the pitch, preparing the ground for us for a pretty tough budget that will include some pain for most people one way or another. Natasha Clark is here, LBC's political editor. That's quite an unusual speech for a Chancellor at that time of day. And she did take questions for a long time, didn't she?
Yeah, definitely. It felt like the pitch was being very rolled out very far, a long way. There was lots of pitch rolling.
3 weeks to go, yeah.
Exactly.
It? Yeah.
And that's not something that usually a Chancellor will do. It's usually in this point where we are at our peak of fevered speculation about what might and what might not be in the budget. And, you know, it's interesting that we are essentially where we were a year ago, aren't we? We were all expecting a really difficult, painful budget after, you'll remember, Keir Starmer gave that really gloomy
Rose Garden
downing
speech.
Yeah, the Rose Garden speech last year. And it feels to me like a bit like we're just there all over again. And that this government are finding themselves in a hole despite the fact that they promised that they weren't going to come back for this extent of tax rises that they did last year, around something, what was it, around £35 to £40 billion worth of tax rises at the last budget. It feels like that's exactly where we are in terms of the ballpark again. £20 to £30 billion is what I'm hearing that the Chancellor has to grapple with to try to fill that. And of course, it is still really early to speculate. It's 3 weeks out, and the way that it works between the Office for Budget Responsibility and the Treasury is they go there and back between all their different forecasts, and they do change day by day, week by week. So it might be that we do get to budget day and the Chancellor is better than expected figures come in.
But this could be the it could be terrible. Look at me, I'm really clever. It's not as bad as we thought.
Well, that's kind of what I thought when I heard Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's questions last week. I thought, there's no way. Surely they are just pitch rolling it up to be so, so bad. And then at the budget, she can stand up and say, I kept all of my promises to you, the British public, and everybody cheers and the Labour MPs go delighted. But today, that feels far less likely, doesn't it? It feels today like she really is in a hole. And actually, I thought her demeanour, I don't know if you watched it on the television.
No, I was just listening.
You were listening, but if in the room, watching her, she felt quite worried, a little nervous, a little apprehensive, her attitude. It felt a little bit like she genuinely felt like the weight of the world was on her shoulders a little bit, and that she didn't come across as a woman who was looking forward to the budget in any way.
That's
which isn't surprising.
That didn't translate to me as somebody...
It's amazing
the difference between listening to someone, watching and listening to somebody, or reading their words. You do metabolise them very differently, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. And I think she came across as more nervous, definitely, in person. Right. But she kicked off the speech today by basically trying to lay the groundwork for this budget about what she feels is going to be the difficult choices that she's going to have to make. She started by talking about why she feels that the situation has changed. She talked about blaming the last government, COVID, Brexit and austerity for the mess that we're in.
The truth is that previous governments have not adequately faced up to these challenges. Too often, political convenience has been prioritised over economic imperative. The decision to pursue a policy of austerity after the financial crisis dealt a hammer blow to our economy, gutting our public services and severing the flows of investment that would have put our country on a path to recovery. And then a rushed and ill-conceived Brexit that brought further disruption, as businesses trying to trade were faced with extra costs and extra paperwork.
And this, I think, Sheila, was the key bit. She said that everybody would have to do their bit.
If we are to build the future of Britain together, we will all have to contribute to that effort. Each of us must do our bit for the security of our country and the brightness of its future.
And then Sheila in the Q&A afterwards, of course, all the speculation is about whether she is going to raise income tax. This was her reply to that question.
I will set out the individual policies at the budget on the 26th of November. That's not what today is about. Today is about setting the context for that budget. As Chancellor, I have to face the world as it is, not the world that I want it to be. And when challenges come our way, the only question is how to respond to them, not whether to respond or not. And as I respond at the budget on the 26th of November, my focus will be on getting NHS waiting lists down, getting the cost of living down, and also getting the national debt down.
So you heard there her three priorities, but not including keeping